and we expect other folks to arrive. We do expect having a quorum, which is, I think is 11. Good morning. This is a meeting of the Joint Policy Committee. Do we need to do roll call, Fred, or do we just need to make sure, see who's here? Where did Fred go? Fred? No. Yeah. We're good, right? We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 11's a quorum? What's a quorum?
Is 11 a quorum?
What's a quorum? 11, we have 9 here. 1, 2, because we have, Dave, you're on this, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, we have 10. We have 10 here, Fred, so one more for a quorum, I think.
So, hopefully she'll walk right in. There's
an item, the minutes.
Yes.
They're a little rich, and we weren't able to get the minutes.
Okay.
Prepared,
right.
So sorry
about
that. Right. Yes. I don't think the Caltrans is counted.
I didn't count. I don't think I counted them.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah, so we have 10 here. Yeah. We need one more, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Julie's on her way.
Okay. All right. Good morning. We do have 10. We need one more for a quorum, and Julie Pierce will be here shortly. I'm just going to say the items.
Yeah.
All right, we are going to skip over item 2 since we do not have minutes, so those will be presented at the next meeting. Item 3 is report of the Executive Committee. The Executive Committee met last week and had discussion on SB 792, of which we made no recommendations other than to ask for that item to be on the full agenda with full presentations, which is item 5 today. And we did have a report on our JPC climate program, a shortened version of the full version of it will be today as well. So that was the meeting of the Executive Committee. So with that, we will move on to item 4, which is a report on the Joint Policy Committee climate program. And so we'll turn it over to Bruce Reardon to report on key findings from county meetings. There's been a number of meetings around the Bay Area, and then we'll hear a little bit about the Climate Readiness Institute.
Thank you, John. Good morning to you. We have a handout to you, but we had a few printing problems, so my staff person will be here in about 2 minutes with a handout. I'll talk slowly until then. So, we're going to talk about two things this morning as the report on the climate project that we're doing for the Joint Policy Committee. And the first part, we'll be talking about the county meetings that we've been doing county by county over the last 3 months, meeting with stakeholders in each of the 9 counties. And then we'll also talk about the Climate Readiness Institute that was launched last month with our help at Berkeley, with Berkeley and Stanford and Davis involved. So first, on the county reports, we have been out for the last 3 months meeting with stakeholders, city and county and NGO stakeholders working on climate adaptation, or some that should be working on climate adaptation, in each of the 9 counties. And we met with a total of 140 people. You can see on the screen the types of staff that we met with. So we're not just talking to climate people or sustainability staff. We're talking to public works and planning and health and water, a whole set of things across the board. We've been asking them two basic questions. What are your projects? What are your plans? Where are you going with climate adaptation work, and where are you right now? What projects do you have underway? And secondly, what are the barriers to your city or your county taking action and moving ahead in a more accelerated way on climate adaptation? We were running these meetings, and we had 15 to 25 of your stakeholders in each county. We co-hosted the meetings with a county entity in each case. So Solano Transportation Authority was our co-host in Solano. In Marin, it was the nonprofit Marin Clean Climate and Energy Partnership. In San Mateo, it was the county. So we had a co-host that helped us invite and bring stakeholders in each of the 9 counties. We were doing this for three reasons. First was to inspire and inform. We've already started a second round of meetings with the counties to talk to them about what the other eight counties are doing. The second reason was to help us in our design on the what's going to be our regional hub, providing assistance to cities and counties and others on climate adaptation. And so getting a better idea of what the needs were in every city and every county was a big part of why we did these meetings, so we could design the hub services. And the third, and one we'll probably spend some time on with you here this morning, was to provoke and inform a discussion on the great need here for more integrated state and regional and local planning around climate adaptation. So Aleka Seville is my project staff on this and has joined us now. We have a handout for you in just a second when we get to the two more slides. So what did we find in the nine county meetings? We found about what we're calling 60 spotlight projects, really exemplary projects that we pulled out of each county, and there were spotlight projects across all nine counties. On sea level rise, on water, on energy, some cross-sector projects, some on land and natural systems. We found about 40, more than 40 now, climate action plans in the region, and we found some of those, as we'll talk about in a minute, where climate is now being pushed into general plans or pushed into hazard mitigation plans. We found some level of county coordination. That was one of the things we were looking for, our counties playing a role to bring cities together and help cities move ahead, since especially with smaller cities, hard to make that kind of progress on your own. So were counties providing coordination was one of our questions. And we also talked to them at length about the barriers that they're finding to action and their recommendations, their suggestions to us as to what should be done about the barriers.
So why don't we pass out the chart?
Okay.
Yeah. So we have a chart for you, since we didn't think that anyone's eyesight was good enough for the slide here, and we'll bring that around. We've made a matrix. We've constructed a matrix that will summarize some of the findings so that you can see them across the region and you can see them kind of county by county. So I'll just pause for a second. So if you'd look at there are two pages. If you'd look at the one that says in the upper left-hand corner, spotlight projects. I'm going to talk about this one for a few minutes, and then Aleka is going to talk about the other one. I'll take one, too. So this is the matrix that summarizes what we're calling our spotlight projects. They're projects that we think have great replicability. They're projects that we think could have a great impact if moved across the regions. We think these are projects with a fair amount of innovation in terms of approach or funding for the project, and so they're worth being a spotlight so that we can show them to other counties and get them out of one county or out of two counties and across the region. You'll see in the first row that we have the greatest number of these spotlight projects around the topic of sea level rise and extreme storms and flooding. And that's not to be surprised. There are more projects, period, and more work being done in the region along those issues. In the second row, there's also a fair amount of work being done by the water agencies, the 10 major water supply agencies and others in the region, and we've called out a couple of different projects here to spotlight. Every water district, you'll be happy to know, is working on climate adaptation and water supply issues. We've called out a few of the projects that we thought were worth noting. In energy, there's, again, a fair amount of work going on Marin Clean Energy, some of the other important energy programs here, of course, PG&E's work to strengthen our infrastructure across the region. Land and natural systems, we were, these are mainly located, as you might expect, in the northern counties that we have for the region. But you'd see some interesting projects, the Marin Carbon Project, a series of projects in Sonoma County and all around natural systems and land. Health, there's work going on climate and health in all of the counties, but only a few that we would actually elevate to kind of spotlight level. And this is a need that we've identified with health advocates and health departments, that there's a bigger gap probably in the health field between need and resources than in any other piece that we have going right now. And then there at the bottom, there's a series there's a listing of some of the projects that hit multiple impacts. So they're not just about water, just about sea level rise, just about heat, just about public health, but things across the board. I'll show you a few logos here of spotlights of spotlights. There are some projects and some project sponsors that have clearly led the way on climate adaptation planning in the region and are kind of blazing the trail for us here. So to mention just a few, adapting to rising tides, which you're pretty familiar with from all of the work that BCDC and the other agencies have done here on the ART project over the last couple of years in Alameda County, and really blazing the trail there in an important way on bringing all the stakeholders together. And you'll see this in a minute when we talk about the need for greater structure. ART has already demonstrated the ability, the great benefit in bringing diverse stakeholders together around a topic. On the right, the chart that you see there is a great example of going deep in terms of future scenario planning. This is the San Francisco PUC's analysis of their Hetch Hetchy water supplies under different climate scenarios. And this was one of the charts that they produced from that work. And again, blazing the trail on really going deep in terms of the science and working to see what's the future going to bring, in this case, for the San Francisco water supply and for all the agencies in the South Bay and the Peninsula that SFPUC provides water to. The NAPA project has been going for many years, and it really blazed a trail in terms of self-funding. This was a project that NAPA conceived with, again, a very diverse set of stakeholders to deal with a problem that was affecting business and infrastructure and transportation and natural systems and residents in their homes and all with chronic flooding Napa River and Napa Creek, and they came up with a half-cent sales tax to tax themselves and passed it. And so this is, you know, blazing a trail for some things we're going to have to do in other areas in the region so that we can afford the kinds of rather big-ticket projects that are going to be needed to deal with climate impacts. Silicon Valley 2.0 has really blazed a trail in the last year on a very detailed needs assessment and vulnerability assessment across 9 different sectors in Santa Clara County. It's $1 million SGC grant that they got. AECOM has been, the consulting firm has been doing most of the work, and it's really a great model for other counties now to be looking at how to do a detailed needs assessment of climate impacts on business, on residents, on transportation, on a whole series, on public health across the board. Marin Clean Energy, we've talked about before. They really are the model, and they've been the model now. Sonoma's following in their footsteps starting in May with Sonoma Clean Power in terms of taking more local control over energy sources, building out energy efficiency programs, feed-in tariffs. Marin Clean Energy is now working with Tesla on storage for renewables, all sorts of innovative programs on the energy front by taking more local control at the county level over energy sources and over energy generation. And finally here, or not finally, I have two more. I'll put this next one up too in the middle. A terrific, again, kind of blazing the trail piece here, where Bay Area Council went to foundations and got money for a major study that's going on now on the the economic impacts to the Bay Area of a storm like Sandy or an extreme storm scenario for the Bay Area. And again, taking this out of the realm of this is a possibility, but bringing it down to dollars and cents, what's it going to mean to this region to be hit by a storm like that, and what are the costs going to be that we could avoid by taking action ahead of time? And finally, Oakland Climate Action Coalition is easily our best model in the region of something we need more of, which is getting community-based organizations organized and involved and engaged in climate planning. The Oakland Climate Action Coalition got funding from a couple of foundations and hired a coordinator and pulled the community-based organizations together so they could be a very aggressive and helpful working partner with the city of Oakland in developing their climate action plan. And it resulted in a much bolder plan, it resulted in a much stronger plan, and it resulted in getting the plan passed through their city council. So those are some spotlights of spotlights. We can answer questions about them, but Aleka is going to talk a little bit now about the second page on your matrix.
Great. So throughout these county-by-county meetings, we also investigate or ask stakeholders about their climate action planning activity. So you'll see in each of the county summaries, there's documentation of which cities and counties actually have climate action plans. And do we want to put on the next slide so I can see?
Sorry.
That's okay.
I
mean, it's so big, I'm sure you can read it anyway. So under CAP goals, climate action planning goals, we documented basically which cities have climate action plans already adopted and what their GHG reduction goals are. And as you can see, there's quite a bit of diversity around goals in the Bay Area. And this includes, I should mention, county climate action plans as well, because there's a few of those too. So Alameda County, I just want to point out here, is one of the, Alameda and Sonoma really, are the counties where every city has adopted a goal. Every city has adopted a GHG reduction goal. You'll see in Alameda that there's quite a few disparate goals. They're somewhat similar. Many of the cities decided to go along with the state's AB 32 goal. And so that's reflected here. But many of the cities decided to really establish a goal based on their own local priorities. So this is documentation of that. Of course, as we've mentioned previously, having a climate action plan obviously doesn't mean that there is, you know, funding or resources for implementation for all the strategies outlined in those. But we do think it's important to understand what the landscape looks like at the moment and what those goals are. So we also did a quick review of these plans to see whether or not cities and counties had talked about local adaptation strategies within those plans. And you'll see in the plans that are, you know, 2010 and afterwards, it's much more likely that a city or county would have been talking about local adaptation planning. But, you know, they're really few and far between at this point. So we're seeing a little bit of activity there, but it's definitely not consistent across the board. We also asked about climate planning getting into other formal planning processes, so specifically general plans and hazard mitigation plans. And there's a couple examples here. You know, Berkeley's hazard mitigation plan, it's their 2014 draft update. They actually list three man-made hazards of concern, and those are hazard materials release, terrorism, and climate change. And so that was one of the things that we wanted to note here. This is definitely getting into hazard mitigation and general plans. And this, we note here that this is a partial list. This could definitely be further researched. Once we started asking this question, we realized how important it actually was. And we realized how many people were thinking about this. And I think, you know, San Francisco is an example where they're now actually putting climate into their long-term capital planning process. And that's being done through their SF Adapt process along with the PC and many other departments. So that's actually something to note. And it's very forward-thinking in terms of future funding opportunities. So that's why they're looking to that process. We also, do you want me to talk about authority? We also asked each county whether or not they had any type of structure to bring cities and counties together around climate. And so, as you can see from the reports, we have a broad definition of project and a broad definition of structure. But that's actually served us well because our counties in the Bay Area, as you know, are so unique. So we documented here, if you go into the bottom row, any sort of countywide coordination that was happening here, and then the type of that. So you can note there's a JPA in Alameda. In Contra Costa, we have 4CL, or Contra Costa Climate Leaders. It's a nonprofit organization that's done an incredible amount of work to document what's going on there. The Marin Clean Energy Partnership is also a nonprofit involving city officials and city staff. San Francisco is the county that actually has a Department of the Environment, and they do quite a bit of coordinating work across agencies there. I wanted to note the RICAPS, so it's the Regionally Integrated Climate Action Planning Suite. And RICAPS is actually funded by the Air District, some funding from the Air District and PG&E. And what that does is they're providing technical assistance for each of their cities to develop climate action plans. So the cities can work directly with folks at KEMA. There's a extensive amount of guidelines and tools for the cities to use. And so it's a great coordinating structure, but it's actually, that working group or that group of people is sort of survives beyond the climate action planning. And it's been an incredible group for them to have as a resource. Silicon Valley 2.0, I'll also point out here as well, a fantastic project funded by the Strategic Growth Council. They have multiple agencies involved. They have nonprofits involved. Their health department is involved. And they're working with AECOM to develop a risk assessment tool, a vulnerability assessment tool for the county around adaptation. But that working group serves this purpose of this coordinating structure. So we have a few examples here. Again, as you know, Sonoma County is the only county that has a regional climate protection authority. It's the same board as their transportation authority, and it's actually legislated through the state. And they were able to create that as a model. And it's part of the reason that, as you can see in Sonoma, there's quite a bit happening around climate adaptation. And it's largely because of their leadership and their coordination around that authority. So that climate authority column, as you can see, we wanted to document that Sonoma is the only one that actually has that in place.
Great. Thanks, Aleka. Thank you, Aleka. And we have for you to take away a summary, a 5 or 6 page summary of the findings online. There are each of the county reports, and actually for each of you, we have your own county's 10 or 12 page summary. And we thank your stakeholders for giving us a tremendous amount of input and help with all this. So to finish up, the good news is what we just showed you. There are probably more than 60 innovative spotlight projects, and we have more climate adaptation work being worked into climate action planning and some even into general planning, hazard mitigation planning. But we've surfaced with your stakeholders a series of barriers that are actually quite serious, that are holding us back, and that we're going to have to solve if we're going to get to real climate adaptation work in the region. And I'll go through them quickly here. And in yellow here, your gold, you'll see at the bottom, these are some of the resources, obviously, that we have that could be applied to the barriers and to the actions that we're showing you in just a minute. So the first one is the need for a more unified and coordinated planning and governance structure. Roles and responsibilities are unclear on climate adaptation. It's a fragmented approach that we've taken to what is really a system of issues that are interconnected. And authority is unclear in some places. It's clearer in some than in others, and conflicting even on some topics. So you'll see for each of these five, we have a recommended action. And the recommended action here would be to construct a unified and coordinated planning process and structure. That could take, in terms of next steps, a study of how to do this. It could take a working group of pulling together folks in the region. It could take legislation. And it would certainly need to build on work that's been done on governance and adaptation by BCDC, by Berkeley Law, Hoover Commission, and others. Second is resources. We've talked to you about this before. The challenge is greater than the resources we have available, but we don't know by what level. We don't know the quantified answer there. traditional public sector dollars are not going to be there in the levels that we think we need for this, and medium and small cities, frankly, are going to be left behind. We found medium and small cities wanting to work on these issues across the region, but only large cities been able to put resources to it and actually make progress at this point. That's not going to work when you have a system and you have energy infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, water and all running through small cities as well as large cities. It's a network that we have. And a recommended action again here to engage not just public sector but philanthropic and private sector to create a new financing approach. We're going to need more creative thinking here. Third, shared goals. We have no compelling picture of what the future really should look like for the Bay Area in terms of being a resilient and a adaptive region. We have few goals. We have some on certain areas, but none on others. They're fragmented. We have nothing that's really very measurable in terms of where we're going with this and where we'd like to be. So how can we know if we're making progress? So a whole series of issues around goals and indicators, and again, a recommendation here that you can see to create that system, to work and build on some of the work that's been done in the region, but convene a working group and all to create that kind of system. We're not saying here yet who has to do all these different things. We're bringing to you the high-level first cut of what needs to be done, and we can talk later about who and when. A fourth, science and data, incomplete, conflicting, confusing data. We've seen people just overwhelmed by which data to use to be planning for climate impacts. The data is often not actionable at the local level. It may be at a regional or state level, but it's not helpful for local planners. And researchers and practitioners are working separately. And we need to put them together. So developing the Climate Readiness Institute, which some of you were able to attend our launch in February, with Berkeley, Stanford, and all, bringing together academics and practitioners, we think is the entirely right road to go here on this one. And finally, the working environment. We had a meeting with health officers and health staff from the nine counties last night in San Mateo, Gene and Allison and myself. Staff can't keep up. I'll take the health as an example. Staff working on health issues in each of the counties cannot keep up with the state and federal and science issues and data on climate adaptation. They want to work on it. Some of them are starting to work on it, but they can't keep up. They need some help with that, and we found this across the sectors. It's kind of an inefficient and siloed and isolated system, and people really are asking for something, some sort of a network that will bring them together, let them work with each other across sectors and work within sectors. So we're recommending that kind of a learning network, which could be or should be the regional hub that we've been talking to you about for, it seems like, about 10 years, but we're getting developed with money from the JPC and with money from Kresge and others. That's our five barriers. They're significant and serious. We have a serious problem, and our stakeholders, your city and county people, have given us great feedback on what needs to be done to move us ahead. Thank you.
So, Bruce, why don't you have a very quick presentation on the Climate Readiness Institute launch, and then we can talk here about next steps on these items. Okay. So if you can do that briefly.
Yeah. I kind of included it there, but I'll just say February 11th, we launched what we've been working on for a year and a half with Berkeley, Stanford, and Davis. Some of the people in the room were able to attend the launch, where the idea behind the Climate Readiness Institute is with outside funding. Berkeley is doing the fundraising for this right now. We're going to have a forum to bring together practitioners and academics to work on the top issues around climate adaptation and resilience in the region. So we've launched it. We've gotten interest now from the right parties, both private sector, from foundations, from the universities themselves, and from the public sector. We have a small working group that Allison and I are both on to, and Aleka to organize the structure of the Climate Readiness Institute, where it's going to live and who's going to run it and all of that. And as I said, Berkeley is out doing the primary fundraising for it now. We worked through a lot of the input the other day in a working session, this organizing group. The input we got at the launch was mainly about what should the CRI take on, what are the big issues, and you'll see some of them. You saw some of them here in the slideshow. Thank you.
Thank you. So really the purpose today was to hear about all the work that's going on in the Bay Area and some of the regional work, and really have a discussion here, not necessarily today, but have a discussion of what role the four regional agencies, through the JPC or not, have in helping provide a facilitated role in or a common goal here in the Bay Area. So one of the things that would seem to make sense is, I know the four executive directors will often meet over how to reach consensus on moving forward. And I don't know if you've had, and we're going to get into the next item on your discussion on SB 792, but has there been any recent discussion by the executive officers over how to coordinate and facilitate this work from a regional perspective? And then we'll go around and have discussion here, but first to hear from the four directors briefly. And sort of, I mean, each of the four agencies have a role, clearly, on climate change. And, I mean, the idea is trying to find the ability to work together through the JPC on how to achieve a more stronger regional progress.
The answer is yes. We have had some conversations, and part of the conversations is how challenging this work is, and we would include Allison in that conversation. our thought was to amend SB 792 so that we would incorporate at least the indicators that are coming up in the review from Bruce into Plan Bay Area as a thought piece for the state to begin thinking about how to institutionalize all this information. I think clearly we're all aware of the inefficiency of having, you know, 100 different jurisdictions involved in one level of this or another, and, you know, hundreds of special districts as well who are impacted by it. But none of our agencies are organized to take this task on in any substantive way. And I think as the furthest we could go was to create these assessments and indicators. And I think that's actually a very good step.
Larry?
I was actually going to mention a way in which we've started to do this, which is that ABAG and BCDC are working together on shoreline resilience and recognizing that there's the State Coastal Conservancy also doing the same thing. We decided to link arms and actually use a facilitator to help us work better together, and we have now created a 6-month and 2-year integrated work plan so that everything that we are doing, knock on wood, will actually end up being integrated in such a way that it can point to either the SCS in 2017 or some other type of productive, some type of productive benefit. And so from the shoreline resilience plan or side of it, that's, I think, the way we decided to work, which is to actually just sort of wrap your arms around everything that we're all doing and trying to integrate it in that way.
Steve?
I think my own view is probably slightly different. I think there's only so far we can push the SCS model because it's nested within this, I think, quite well-defined state statutory framework for mitigating what we're doing to try to reduce the effects of climate change. And that has a whole scoping plan with responsibility assigned to different sectors, and then within those sectors, institutions that have a job to do. I think we need something like that for adaptation. And I think until we have it, we're going to continue to have all of these folks running around, you know, trying to do good things, but in a completely haphazard and uncoordinated way. So that's not just a Bay Area problem. That's mm-hmm. a statewide problem. And I do think until we have a statewide framework for moving forward, we're going to struggle with this subject.
Jack, I know there was discussion at Air District this year, or this week, excuse me, on our climate action plan there.
Right. John, that was just yesterday.
Right.
So
I'm losing track of the days this week. Yes, I know it was this week.
Just yesterday. No, John. I think from the Air District's perspective, we see the climate crisis, if you will, is an important issue. It is something that we feel that we play an important role in terms of at the Air District. And, of course, we're going to have a conversation about 792 and what our role should be there as well. But I think the framework that Steve was talking about is necessary. I think there's a whole conversation about adaptation that needs to occur that doesn't exist right now as on a regional level. But as far as the Air District and just the just climate in general, we have stepped out in, I think, an important role here, as you know, John, very recently in terms of the putting forth a work program that would identify a series of steps for ourselves at the Air District that would update our inventory, identify some additional resources that, frankly, speak to the points that are being raised here for climate action plans. And so the district sees the climate as an important effort as a whole. We see that the SES actually plays an integral part of it, but it isn't it the be-all, if you will, mm-hmm. for climate. It is part of a larger picture, if you will. And that's AB 32 and all the other assorted efforts as well. So
right. And
can I add to that? Because I want to agree with Steve and Jack in a big way in that what we're doing with Azure, for example, in the Coastal Conservancy, we know that a big part of that's going to end up in the SCS or inform the SCS. But a lot of it won't. And so the question is, how does that other stuff that doesn't actually get sorted out in a way that helps in some other fashion? And I just want to tell you all that yesterday we testified, BCDC testified, with the Conservancy and the State Lands Commission and the Coastal Commission and the Ocean Protection Council before the Senate Budget Committee, sub number two, because the Senate Budget Committee, and I gather the Assembly is going to do the same thing, has decided that it wants to look at adaptation really for the first time. And the consultant has said, look, we think that mitigation is going along the way mitigation should be going along, but we're really concerned about the adaptation. So the legislature is now starting to look at that. We have legislation in SB 1184, which essentially would codify what we're doing now, and that will be heard on April 22nd, again, as part of a way for us to be able to move forward on the adaptation side.
Great. So, in the next item where we talk about any potential changes to SB 792 that was discussed by all of you, we're going to talk a bit about the climate change role. So we go around, Mark? So why don't we go around this way on comments, starting with Mark.
Thank you. And as we did talk yesterday about having a grand unified theory that's translatable. I mean, we've got string theory, we've got inflation, we've got multiverses, and we really just have these multiverses of different things, all trying to go to the same goal, but in different ways. And one of the things I'm concerned about is the translation to the wider circle of our fellow public servants who have to effectuate whatever action plan is brought together by this great group and other great groups, the translation to the city councils and how they actually effectuate any of this to their community. And how does the average person, you know, they've got to pick the kids up at 5, they've got to go to school at 7, they've got to do dinner in between. How do they fit climate change activities into their life? I mean, and so what I'm concerned about is, one, at this level, at least thinking, I'm heartened to see that at least the goals and the dates, like 2020, are synced up a little better than I thought they were. And, of course, we have to wait for CARB to come up with their midterm date. But I think one of the great things we can do before 2020, which is only 5 3/4 years away, is come up for plain people like us and Martinez and other communities, what is the date that we're supposed to have it? How much? What's the percentage we're shooting for? Who, you know, what can we do? What menu of items can we do in our community? All the other stuff, which is much more important, the adaptation, the resiliency, the deeper planning, is important. That has to go on. But I think there's a need for translation to get out rather quickly to our wider circle of public servants that informs them about the grand unified theory we're trying to achieve.
Right. Thank you.
Thanks.
And I'd like to follow up on those comments, Mark. I really appreciate that. From my local county supervisor's hat on, I think the need for coordination is really significant in this area, and the need for shared information and just sort of a pathway through all the analysis and all the work that's being done by so many of our different entities. But we also need, I think, to be very mindful of the local process and make sure that the coordination that we need to achieve, particularly for adaptation efforts at a regional level, is not lost in translation for the localities. There's so much strong individual concern, if I can use that more neutral word, by some of our residents who just have an anti-plan by area mentality, not to put too fine a spin on it. And I want to make sure that our future conversations on these very important issues that affect many of our people right where they live, because they will be underwater soon, is not that they don't stop listening and lose an ability to listen and plan and participate because they perceive something to be a regional plan that's being forced upon them. And so I think creating this balance of regional planning and integration while making sure that the integrity of the local participation process is maintained, it's not easy, but it's really crucial if we're going to get individual engagement from city councils and from our residents.
Those who are wishing to speak are speaking, right? You don't have to, but if you have a comment.
I thought it was required. Just a couple quick comments. Certainly I agree with the comments that have been made, and in fully engaging the locality, the local governments, is critical. We all know that. A lot of the work that Bruce and Aleka have done have been aimed at that, so that's going on. As difficult as our challenges appear, it's important to recognize that we live in this wonderful pluralistic society. Part of what that means is that there are lots of organizations out there doing lots of things, and many of them are positive. Now, in trying to get coordination, that can be very frustrating. Kate and I were at a meeting yesterday of our rising sea level subcommittee at BCDC, and heard from a nonprofit called Cool the Earth, which decided after an inconvenient truth didn't mobilize enough people in Marin to aim at a real action program primarily focused on 6 to 9 year olds. Mm-hmm. They're in 500 schools across 38 countries where the kids get coupon books to talk about things they can do and things their parents can do. Now, it's not adaptation, and it's going to be very hard to use that kind of approach for adaptation. But there's a whole line here of things that we need to keep in mind, not get distracted by. The other side of that is that BCDC working through the JPC and these other communications that Larry talked about is absolutely reaching out in every way we can. At the same time, we are marching forward as fast as we can, which of course is not very fast, to figure out what we can do to adapt specifically to rising sea level, because that one we know is coming whatever else we do with mitigation. So, yeah, very complex. We need to keep working on these kinds of things and plowing through. But there are rays of hope out there.
Other comments?
Just quickly, a little following up on that. I'm so aware in San Francisco of the changing nature of our population, the young people who are beginning to take over our world. And I'm actually very happy because they are willing to take action on things that many of us have not been able to. So my main point is just to add to sort of what Zach said, that we need to put this out in terms that we motivate the young people who are ready to protect their future and think in a little different way about communication. So there are so many people out there, they're flocking to San Francisco and other areas, and I know that we could find resources among them, maybe through the climate resiliency program, whatever, to communicate better and motivate them to be leaders in this. Thank you.
Going through any comments? Scott?
Yeah, I mean, you know, listening, I tend to break things down into very simple things and what I can grasp. And what I really heard out of this whole thing is we're out trying to do some pretty good work. There's good people assembled around the table. We have a lot of other cats out there that are being trying to be heard, trying to herd them. And everybody's heart is in the right place. And we need more science and data work. We need a lot of work. But yet we don't have the money to get the job done. That's what I heard. And I hate to say this, but money cures all. If you want to herd cats, just all of a sudden step up and say you have a bunch of money to do this work.
We're going to hear about cap and trade later, Scott. Yeah, maybe that's some money.
All kind of fall in. Well, actually, John, I was thinking of going in a different direction. I thought maybe we look at doing a temporary vehicle license fee, a buck, a couple bucks, nine Barry County wide, to see if we could get somebody to carry that legislation. And then all of a sudden now we've got, you know, an infusion of money, and all of a sudden everybody wants to join in. And I really think that that's something we need to look at, because it simply does boil down to dollars. Because the minds are here. I mean, I'm not talking about the political minds. I'm talking really about the staff minds that we're looking at, and the ability to either do the work or know where to get the work done. And I really would like to see us carry some sort of legislation. Maybe we could get Lonnie Hancock to carry it. That would put a couple bucks on the license fee for, you know, 5 years. We could make it a temporary thing and always go back and renew it 5 years later.
Right. Hey, I don't want to downplay the political minds that are around this table. Julie.
Yeah, you know, I agree with all the comments so far, and I particularly want to echo something that Bruce said, and that is that many of the communities around the Bay Area are small. We've been devastated by the recession, by the takeaway of redevelopment money. We've all lost staff, some of us to such a bare-bones level that we can barely keep our heads above water. And thinking about a climate action plan in our small city is absolutely impossible. I mean, it's so far down the list of priorities, it doesn't even show up. It's not that we wouldn't love to if we had the resources. So I'm wondering, as we think going forward about what we need to accomplish, if we could work toward getting something like template plans that can be very simply modified to fit circumstances, if we could get sort of a master agreement and things like that, that we could all key off of. And that way there would not only be some structure that is similar, but there would be a lot of the heavy lifting would already be done for the smaller cities. And I think that way those small cities that have the energy networks running through them could be included. And it's not that we don't want to comply with all the stuff. It's just it's physically impossible for us to do it, and certainly financially impossible.
If I may, I would like to agree with what Julie just said, is that we were working on our climate action plan, but we have one person doing it. And she went and got pregnant, and then she had to go out early maternity leave, and so that kind of just that's where NAPA is on our climate action plan. And our planning director went to Palo Alto. So those two positions, that's how lean we are at that spot. I want to reinforce the need for that the Climate Readiness Institute, whoever we're able to hire to come into these positions are going to need that backing, that education, and because we're going to be recreating something.
Any other comments? So, yes.
I think part of what we're talking about is the institutionalization at the local government level for how we absorb information that we can create that has an economy of scale. And clearly we need an economy of scale. So from my perspective, the advanced planning function within each city, to the extent that it exists as a person or it resides within the planning manager, is a good place to start. And while we think of the SCS, the Sustainable Community Strategy, at one level as a series of transportation investments that serve a land use plan, there's a whole second element to Plan Bay Area, which is how the planning managers have come together to identify where they can grow, how they can grow, and under what sustainable environmental conditions. So to me, that is the opportunity for us to try to bring information to scale to planning managers and then identify how far that's gone. So that's why I'm an advocate for amending SB 375 to include these indicators so that we can activate that portion of the city of the city government.
Bruce, you had a closing thought.
Just one. Some of the comments speak to just the reason we went to county-by-county meetings and why we went and talked with the health officers and staff of all nine counties last night to try to understand what's an efficient system of bringing them together so everybody's not trying to do this on their own. And the health officers and staff told us last night exactly what they needed, and if we can help provide some of that, they can double or triple what our input is in terms of helping us with both the GHG reduction side and the health messages about climate and about the adaptation side. So I think that, you know, it's a perfect example. We're just trying to find the sweet spot here between a region and 101 cities, and certainly counties could be a major part of that. Thank you.
So this is going to come back to us. In fact, the next item talks about how we may include the climate change in the JPC work. And it seems that there's one issue that at least all four agencies are involved and they're having the discussion here makes sense is climate change, because we're all working on it from local level to regional. All right. So item 5 is SB 792. And let me just briefly open this and then turn it over to Allison. Everyone's aware that Senator DeSaunier's had a bill which addresses the authority and role of the JPC, and his staff invited the JPC and member agencies to submit recommended amendments by the end of March to be considered as the bill moves through the process. And the JPC executive, the executive directors of all four regional agencies and Allison met to talk about where there may be consensus. And so what Allison is going to present, hopefully we get through this part quickly and then move on to where there's not consensus, is where there was consensus from the four executive directors over amendments to 792. And what I'd like to do is maybe go through them quickly individually, see if there is consensus here by all the JPC members. And then move on to the next one, and then there have been some amendments proposed by ABAG that were not necessarily agreed to by the other executive directors, and we'll hear about that. So with that, and it's in your memo, we can follow through the memo from to the Joint Policy Committee from Director, which is Allison, and each of the issues start on page 2. So do you want, we can go through. Sure. And we'll handle each of them individually.
Great. Thank you, Chairman. Also attached is you have the strike-through legislation that captures these consensus points as an attachment in as 792, as well as Ezra's memo, which these points will reference, my memo references later. But we'll just quickly walk through, and I've included the actual language changes that are in the legislation, and if you want to see what was there previously and how this is changing amending that language, you can take a look. So the first point is that MTC and ABAG should remain the adopting agencies for the Sustainable Community Strategy. And we've amended the language to outline what the role of BCDC and the AIR District would be. And that would be provide technical and policy analysis, recommendations, and other forms of consultation as requested by the JPC. And then Also, there was a point later around the role of the JPC in economic development, and that we would, the JPC would manage an advisory committee and provide recommended goals and performance measures, not adopt goals and policies, as was the previous language. So that was the first point. Yeah.
So I want to, so we can take each individually. So there was agreement on the four executive directors on this language. So let me open it up here. It's the, again, under number one. It would say that the Bay Area Quality Management District and BCDC shall provide technical and policy analysis recommendations and other forms of consultation as requested by JPC. And then second, the JPC in consultation with the advisory committee shall recommend goals and performance measures related to the inclusion of economic development opportunities in the SES. So those were the two. So in which there was agreement from the four executive directors. So I should ask, is there consensus or agreement on those here? Or is there objection to them? Okay. If there's agreement, then that will be all right.
Great. So, item number two is regarding in the legislation, there was a language around a consolidation study for the four agencies, I believe. And this identifies the fact that this work is already underway, and the change in the language states the member agencies of the Joint Policy Committee created pursuant to subdivision shall complete an analysis of common functions and identify opportunities to save costs, reduce redundancies, and further the goals of the member agencies. The analysis shall also include a statement as to the expected reduction in the cost of overhead and in the cost of operation and management of the member agencies. And in fact, this work is underway for the Air District, ABAG, and MTC in preparation for moving into the new building, 375 Beale Street. Thank you. And, and this is an acknowledgement that work is already underway.
Okay. Is there consensus on that change? All right.
Well, this is too easy. Right.
Okay. We're leaving time for where there's not consensus.
So item number three. There was a lot of very prescriptive language around numbers of days and that for the community engagement process that we actually, and MTC staff did an analysis of how that would actually truncate the time that the public would have to comment on actual drafts of the next update of the sustainable community strategy. So I won't read through. This is rather lengthy. You can read through.
So you have it here at the bottom of page 2, top of page 3, the modified language on the inclusive community engagement process. Is there any questions on that? Again, there was agreement on all four, by all four executive directors on that. Is there any, was there agreement on that? Yes. Jim?
What do you mean by advisory group? I mean, what does that commission shall convene?
And which number are you talking about now?
I'm on three. Are we on three?
Yes.
Yeah, we're on
yes.
three.
Yeah. The modified language where it talks about the engaged
advisory. A public engagement advisory group?
Yeah. How is that made up?
Right.
What does that mean?
Okay. Steve, did you want to address that or Ezra? Is that?
Commissioner, it's in the bill. That we would create a group to advise us on this public participation plan. We would anticipate trying to rely to the greatest extent possible on the advisory council and I think ABAG's similar advisory group that we both already have instead of standing up something new.
What the language here says, Jim, so I assume this is what we guide us, says the public engagement advisory group shall include but not be limited to, this is where it says persons representing low-income communities, communities of color, seniors, persons with disabilities, business and environmental organizations.
Yeah, I understood
right.
that. What, okay. My issue is if there's one thing we learned in one Bay Area is that our public outreach was a dismal failure, and we cannot repeat that process.
Right, right.
And so I really would like – I want to make sure that this group isn't just going to take us down that path again.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has to be – at least some strategy meetings
right.
as to how we could do in the outreach. I mean, it really, in that public process we had, we never recognized the good things that the cities and counties were doing. Instead of coming in and say,
you're doing the right thing. We want to give you resources. We want to help you. We didn't do that. We came and said, we got a better plan, and here's what you should be doing. That whole thing was upside down, and I don't want to repeat that. And for this to be successful, as you heard from some of these earlier speakers, you better get the public understanding what we're doing, and you better reduce it to a talking point to where people can relate to it. And we're not doing that. And so I'm just bringing this up that I really want to make sure that there's a strategy as to how we bring this forward into the public arena, and that we do have that discussion. I want to make sure this doesn't limit us, and we're going to repeat the same thing.
And Steve, as I look at what the tasks of this public engagement advisory group would be charged to do, it's to address that and have a better plan. Is that your sense?
Well, it is, and I think the operative word is advisory. They're providing advice to the board, and the board makes the decision about how you're going to outreach to the public.
But I just don't want to take the same advice we got last time. And I don't want the same people.
So you're in better shape this time.
I don't want the same people giving me that same advice, because I think it was very flawed. And I just want to make sure we have a process, Steve, that we really talk about how we take that message out into the communities.
Okay. So then we're in agreement on this language?
It does not limit us from doing that.
Okay. All right. Four, which is some broader set of issues, including climate change. So we'll cover the agreement points first.
Yes. So there were some items added in here, I think in response to the fact that there's a need for beginning to think about adaptation and the relationship of mitigation and adaptation. So I'll just read what the amended language includes. Within the jurisdiction of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, a sustainable community strategy adopted on or after January 1st, 2015, shall include a brief needs assessment of economic development, environmental, social equity, and governance indicators as needed to guide the development of future plans. These indicators shall include, but not be limited to, air quality, sea level rise, climate change, and other hazard readiness, including shoreline resilience and long-term recovery from major earthquakes. And we wanted to make sure that there was language included around who we're working with in developing these performance indicators, connecting with experts in the field and other stakeholders across the region, including federal, state, regional, special district, and local government stakeholders, and a wide variety of individuals and organizations from the private and nonprofit sectors with subject matter expertise in the focus areas included in the sustainable community strategy.
Okay. So before we get to where there's disagreement, which is the next item, there's agreement on this. Comments? Yes.
Let me just raise some comments. And again, I having gone through the process of Plan Bay Area for the last number of years, I think we learned a lot in terms of what our opportunities are, what our challenges are, and how we do have the opportunity to bring together the cities and counties and regional agencies to address a number of the issues. I guess the question I have in looking at this language, and I think it's all, these are admirable goals. What I'm a little bit unclear as to, and maybe it picks up on kind of Steve's earlier point about what are the, you know, kind of how does the legal framework and fit into this? I mean, so I'm kind of unclear. I think having these other issues included in our discussions certainly has a lot of merit. I'm not exactly sure how we have the ability from either to include this with the robust nature that we included transportation planning and housing, and then we start to add all these other areas, and I'm really kind of confused about how this would kind of play out. What would any kind of statutory authority be? I mean, we're taking on a lot of issues around these areas, and certainly it's important to have this as part of the discussion. But I'm not quite clear as to how, what's the end game, how this would play out. And so I guess before I would be wanting to take some of these things to Sacramento and especially embed them in legislation to kind of really understand how we would, how this would all kind of happen.
Okay. And I'll ask for Steve to respond, the way the language is written here, it says within the jurisdiction of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, a sustainable community strategy adopted after 2015 shall include a brief needs assessment of, and it lists the various items, and then also language that the work would be completed to the extent financial resources are available to the agencies that comprise the JPC to perform such work, and that the member agencies of JPC, meaning the other regional agencies, shall be responsible for undertaking any work related to the SCS at the regional scale. So it sounds so, Steve, given that it says within the jurisdiction of the MTC, will you, any, when we hear
well,
from you,
that doesn't
others,
mean that I wrote it, Mr. Chairman.
Right.
I think that's just a contrivance to say it's the Nine County Bay Area.
Right.
And I frankly believe my colleagues here had more of a hand in drafting this than I did. But I certainly don't object to it. And to respond, Commissioner, to your concern, the primary focus, as I see it, of these new indicators is on the adaptation question. And I think what it has to do with is just trying to get them into the discussion in terms of an indicator. They're not given the status of standards, and they certainly wouldn't have the status of the housing needs and the transportation planning process, which have statutory heft behind them. They would be in the law, but what we would be doing, I think, is taking sort of the first step to filter these issues into the discussion. But there would be several more steps that we would have to go before I think they would rise to the level of the housing and transportation issues that you all grappled with in the plan. So it's an attempt, I think, to start the conversation about adaptation within the framework of the SCS without going too far. I think that's the intention.
Mm-hmm.
The language could be tweaked a little if it's not quite sounding that way.
Do the other directors, any comments you want to add?
Yes, I agree with Steve's comments. These were resilience indicators. When we were thinking about the performance measures of the plan, and you can see that the performance measures were wide-ranging. They covered social issues like displacement, et cetera. That resilience factors in terms of how did the plan take these issues into account that we've been discussing here for several years now, and embody them into our calculations to be able to explain the narrative of the SCS. And one of the functions of the SCS is to inform the state as to what other resources and considerations they need to make with respect to trying to create compact land use.
I would add that I think we need to look at this language also in relation to the first language, the first paragraph that we actually discussed, which is that the Air Quality Management District and BCDC shall provide technical and policy analysis recommendations and other forms of consultation as requested by the JPC. So as we go forward, knock on wood, with SB 1184 and develop our, with ABAG, our Shoreline Resiliency Program and the Coastal Conservancy, that will inform what MTC and ABAG are doing in the next SCS, and it will be up to all of us to figure out how much of that we put into the SCS as indicators, as analysis, as consultation, as questions that have to be answered to actually have a fully sustainable community.
John, just so you know, just a comment, in the last SCS there were actually air quality indicators that was agreed to. They were PM, if I recall. Mm-hmm. So this is just putting in language that was already done, and of course we'd be in favor of that.
Right. Okay.
So I guess my understanding is I really clearly understand the air quality. We have a system, we've been doing this for 50 years, where we measure air quality at a very fine-tuned level. It's you know, we can do that. I guess some of the other things, I mean, for example, the sea level issue, is this something, for example, is what you're suggesting is that BCDC would take on the responsibility both from a information standpoint as well as financial to do those kinds of studies or bring that kind of information forward in terms of providing those if they're indicators, just as an example. I just kind of want to see how it might play out.
We and ABAG as part of the resiliency program, which includes both rising sea level, rising bay level, and earthquake hazard, and so on, we'll work as hard as we can with the monies that we have in order to get to a point that we can actually provide the SCS, knock on wood, with enough good, solid information that it will actually inform a sustainable community strategy. Testifying yesterday at the Senate Budget Committee, I said, we don't have the money to do this, and because we don't, but we have the money to keep on moving forward as much as we can. So we will do that, and we will do that in partnership with ABAG and the Coastal Conservancy, which isn't part of the JPC, so that we can move as fast as we can and with as much also deliberate speed as we can, so that we don't get into the issues that you all have gotten into as well during the previous SCS, and then inform through consultation with the JPC what that next SCS should contain.
Okay. Great. Good question. So is there consensus on this now that we understood a little more discussion?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I need to go back because Scott and I found what I was looking for. You know, in that it says the public engagement advisory group shall include but not limited to persons representing
that was companies. The previous thing.
Yeah, and I want to go back to that because this paragraph is the structure we used last time that didn't work. And why are we – there's no inclusion here of local elected officials, local representatives, reps from some cities and counties.
You're going back to – I just want to be clear. You're talking about number 3.
Right. Yeah. I went back, yes.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Because I found it. And so okay. I wasn't satisfied. There has to be some – we have to do something different in that paragraph. And so there needs to be some consideration of that. Okay. And I'm just – what I read there is we're just repeating – what we did last time, and it's not a good approach. And so you're going to have some inclusion there of local representatives, local elected officials. Something has to be included in that group because we were precluded last time, and that's what caused the problem.
So, but ultimately, it's MTC and ABAG that make the final decision on the public outreach, but you're saying including other local elected officials in this public engagement advisory group. Is that what you're suggesting, Jim?
I'm suggesting that we get people that are in those communities.
In addition
to... And not all of them serve on MTC.
Right. That's what I mean. In other words, because ultimately this is advisory to MTC and ABAG, and then MTC and ABAG board, which are the elected officials, make the final decision, but you're asking for other electeds who may not be on MTC and ABAG to be on this as well.
Here's what I'm asking for.
Okay.
This group had a hell of an influence on how we went forward. Okay, and I'm saying that you can't do that again. I mean, they're very focused. You know, they're the people that have all the time to come to all these meetings. They influence the process, and it wasn't good for.
Isn't it about who you appoint to this advisory group?
Yes, I'm more concerned about the strategies how we do this outreach. Right. And if you expect to have success, if you go continue in that direction, you are not going to have. You're going to have a lot of pushback. Is what I'm telling you.
So we should add that you're adding local elected officials to this advisory group.
Well, or if I could suggest, Commissioner, one way to do it, since as the chair points out, local elected officials will be making the decision after receiving this advice. What you could ask or include here is that local planning directors, CMA directors be included in this list so that you have representatives of local government.
Steve, that's what I'm looking for, is that we get that feedback so as we go forward with this public process, we know what we're going to be up against.
Right. So we'll add language where it says the public, suggesting language that with the public engagement advisory group shall include, add local planning directors and congestion management agency staff.
Directors. Yeah.
So local planning directors, or rather than the directors, representatives of local planning agencies and congestion management agencies.
Or just simply representatives of local government.
Right. Representatives
I
of local.
I liked what
well,
Steve said.
I think, to be clear, you can include, you can say representatives of, I mean, planning agencies are local government, right? Representatives of local planning agencies and congestion management agencies or other local government agencies, something to that effect. So it's clear, right? And that way you have them involved in that. So that language would be added. Is that fine?
That's
okay.
Perfect. Because, I mean,
okay.
on those congestion management agency, you have mayors,
right.
councilors.
Yes.
You've got the people that are making the decisions in those communities.
Right.
Now they're
okay.
engaged.
Got it. So we're using the term representatives. Okay. So that's broad enough. Scott?
Yeah, and at the interest of continuing to back up the train, I wanted to bring this question up that Jim brought up, but now one a little bit of more substance, just because I don't know what's going on. In the bill, there was some language about BCDC and moving to the new building, which I noticed has been struck. And then I was looking to
yes.
see if it's been added, changed, or anything anywhere else in the bill.
Yes.
Could I just get a brief update? I don't want to really spend a lot of time on it.
Larry?
Sure. The language about moving to the new building was struck because when this was sent to the Appropriations Committee, the Appropriations Committee struck it because it's a state cost. So anything relating to BCDC in the original legislation has been struck. So that is sort of the context in which we are playing now. In our discussions with Senator Saulnier's staff, they are, I think, eager for BCDC to actually move to the building. So we are working with their staff in that vein. In addition, the Senate Budget Committee staff is also eager for BCDC to move to the building. And so those two staffers today and Monday and Tuesday will be talking about how they can move that process forward. The Senate Budget Committee actually, as part of its recommendation, will take up the next time asking DGS, the Department of General Services, for a full report on the programmatic effects of not putting BCDC into the building. And Senator DeSaulnier's staff is seriously considering getting a Bay Area delegation letter moving to the governor and DGS saying it is vital that they actually do move to the building. So that's what's going on. We haven't given up yet.
Okay. So, and we're going to, I have a public comment card. Let me finish. So there's a central agreement that we're going to hear from public comment. We have a central agreement on this change language that we just talked about for number three, about public engagement.
Yeah.
Okay. We're back on four.
Yeah. Well, it sort of applies to all of
right.
these, and I guess I want to pick up on the financing piece of this. You know, I know that there's this companion bill that's moving forward to try to find some money to do the adaptation work and other things. The other thing I think we need to address in this discussion, this language, is including some kind of financing mechanism in this language, because what I'm concerned about is if we move through, present this language, and we don't have a companion financing, you know, guarantee, I really don't see how our existing resources are in a position to finance the level of work that is contemplated
right,
here.
Right.
And so I think that's a real issue, because, you know, we don't know yet what the cost of SB 375 has been for our agencies, even yet. We're still incurring costs. And it was all done without
right.
any additional funds. So I think that's
yeah.
another issue that we need to kind of
right.
address before we, again, even contemplate taking on.
And I think we don't. That's why there's language that says this work will be completed to the extent feasible financial resources are available to the agencies that comprise the JPC to perform such work, because I don't think we're going to answer the finances question today. I assume that was the discussion among the executive directors of why you included this language. So the idea is then the next step is trying to identify, as you say, the financial resources to do this. Some of this may be within budgets of agencies. Some may not be. So that's why it's the work is completed to the extent financial resources are available.
I understand that. But at the same time, we have a responsibility to do credible work. And
right.
so I'm concerned that if some of this language goes forward, there isn't the accompanying resources, then we end up in this push and pull. So
right.
I just think that this
right.
is something for us to be very
right.
cognizant about,
right.
even as we approach mm-hmm. taking on some of these additional elements of this plan.
Right. So are folks fine with this language, essentially, with the language as it's written under number four? Agreement? Okay.
And as you all
and with the direction also about finances. I have a speaker card from Pat Eklund. Why don't you speak now, because we're before we get into the finishing the discussion.
Great. My name is Pat Eklund, and I'm on the City of Novato's City Council. And I also worked for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for 43 years plus. I want to support Supervisor Spearing's comment about the public involvement process that happened with the Plan Bay Area. It was terrible. It was probably, I was embarrassed that I was on the ABAG board. I was embarrassed that I was part of a regional form of government. And so I support wholeheartedly City Council Member Pierce's suggestion that it be local representatives of local governments, because let us decide who is the appropriate person to be able to serve on that advisory group, because planners may not necessarily be experts in public outreach, and same with CMAs. And secondly, it is very unclear what the role is in ABAG on this public outreach. And I think the bill needs to be very clear that the ABAG and MTC boards have to jointly approve a public outreach program. Because if you don't have that, then you're going to have what we had this last time. I felt totally ineffective. I said, this is a terrible process. How do I change it? And I've been told, well, MTC's driving it. Somebody else told me, no, ABAG's driving it. I had no idea how to effect a change. So I highly recommend that you include in there, in this language, that both ABAG and MTC boards have to approve the public outreach plan for future SESs. Great.
Thank you.
And my last comment is on the water issue. I highly encourage that you put that in the next SES.
Great. Thank you. So let me just take two comments. The first comment, I think, is addressed because it says the group shall include representatives of local planning agencies, congestion management agencies, and other local government. So that's broad enough to include that. The second point, to be clear, who's actually approving? I think that's an important point. Who's approving the final engagement strategy? It says here the recommendation to providing the recommendations to the Metropolitan Transportation Commission and developing a draft public participation plan that plans to do all the following. It is ABAG and MTC that jointly adopt this. So shouldn't we say providing recommendations to the Metropolitan Transportation Commission and the Association of Barrier Governments in developing a draft public participation plan? That would seem to make sense because it is joint. Right? Are we fine with that? Yes, okay. That means yes. Okay, so the recommendation is just providing recommendations to MTC and ABAG in developing a draft public participation plan. Great. Because that was joint, right? Right, but we're adding the language to be clear. Right. You're right, it is done jointly. I agree with you, Amy, which is adding the language to make it clear. So we're fine with three, with those changes, correct? Four, we were fine with four where there was the agreement, right? All right, and I want to make sure we have time. We have the executive officer for the Air Resources Board to give us a presentation about cap and trade. So before we do, we have the final area where there was not agreement on the water issue. And why don't I have Ezra just briefly explain what ABAG is proposing and then the other executive directors to briefly state why they didn't agree. And let me just say, I mean, I'm as hopeful that we could get agreement. I mean, ultimately, the JPC is as effective as having all four regional agencies agree. The question is whether one agency's amendments to this bill that affects all or whether it should be done elsewhere. So, Ezra, do you want to go into that?
Yes, thank you. And now we're outside of the realm of performance measures, and we're on to a task that is assigned to ABAG in the Sustainable Community Strategy, which is to do a long-term growth forecast. And as we know, there are significant elements that affect that forecast, and water is one of them. And one of the major factors here is that the supply of water is going to change very significantly. The climate models indicate that there's likely to be a lot less water than previously. And there's a great deal of uncertainty about how these water agencies will be able to service a long-term plan. Certainly, there are urban water management plans in place now that were based, from what I understand, the prior paradigm where we had, some degree of stability, although it's recognized that Bay Area water supply is the most variable in the United States and highly sensitive to changes in the atmosphere. It's recently stated that 50% of the Bay Area water is obtained in 5 to 10 days of intensity of rain and snow. In any event, we felt that some authority needed to be conferred upon ABAG to do this analysis of water. But there are two reasons why I am now recommending that we withdraw this provision. One, I could not draft language that would eliminate or reasonably eliminate the legal liability of MTC for adopting a sustainable community strategy with even a water assessment, no matter what language I put in, that could trigger litigation that we've just experienced is expensive and not necessarily in our interest to deal with. That was one. The second is that while many people don't realize that about a third of the ABAG organization deals with water, and we are managing the Irwin process for the Bay Area water agencies, I did not receive a good signal from our key staff that this was ready for inclusion in a bill, and that there was a lot more work that needed to be taken, that needs to take place at the water agency level, the water agency discussion, before we insert something like this. Now, it's been my experience that until you put something in a bill, you don't get noticed. And we put this in the bill. It's been sent out. It's been noticed. And now it's in our opportunity to enter into a dialogue to see if we can make some progress. I also want to comment that the legislature cannot mandate that the water agencies do this work without paying for it. And that constitutional mandate of trying to ask agencies to do things that are integrated into other things that they ask for, like the SCS, is one of our huge constitutional problems. We volunteered to do it to avoid that problem, but I don't think it's workable. So I'm recommending that I withdraw it.
Okay. So at this point, it's been withdrawn. I have one speaker on this item, and then we'd like to go to our next item. So John Coleman from President of the Association of California Water Agencies and East Bay MUD Director and with the Bay Planning Coalition.
Great. Thank you very much, Chair Joy and Commissioners. I'd like to, I know you're taking the water equation off the table. I think you need to have some facts. Most water agencies, including those in the Bay Area, have reduced their usage dramatically. Let me put this in perspective. So when you start talking water, you're not being persuaded by inaccurate facts. East Bay MUD, since 1976, the drought of all droughts, our population has gone up by 300,000 or one-third. Our water usage has gone down by one-third. That has happened with numerous agencies. Unfortunately, the agencies that are having problems right now are agencies which have a small number of ratepayers that have not had the funds available to go forward and diversify their portfolio, as has Contra Costa Water, San Francisco, Santa Clara, Sonoma County, and East Bay MUD, as well as those in other parts of the state. So when you start talking water, you need to have the facts straight. Thank you.
Thank you, John. There was one other proposed amendment that ABAG had proposed that I understand there was a difference of opinion. And frankly, so that we can hear the cap and trade presentation, since the executive officer drove an hour to get here from Sacramento, if there's going to be a dispute between MTC and ABAG, I'm not sure we're going to resolve it here in a half an hour. So
I think we will. Another key factor that goes into the growth plan that we wanted to highlight is the absence of affordable housing money has created a condition where the low-cost housing in the Central Valley is creating this very large interregional commute, and we are seeing trends that's accelerating. We believe that the purpose of the Sustainable Community Strategy is to present a realistic or as accurate portrayal of what is happening in this region. And we do not see the laws of supply and demand matching up to allow that interregional commute to dissipate. And so we wanted to be certain that that was included in the analysis and that we not have to question whether or not the language in the other parts of the bill could possibly be interpreted in that way. However, we have executed a settlement agreement along with MTC with the Building Industry Association that touches upon this subject in some manner that needs further discussion. And I think it's been misinterpreted that there was any intent to change what the outcome of that settlement agreement was. We didn't believe that this provision did that, but I think that was contested by the Building Industry Association. So we are, again, withdrawing this provision and hope to have meetings with the Building Industry Association and along with MTC and ourselves to try to resolve how we best interpret and implement this settlement agreement. Thank you.
Though you're recommending, in the memo, the language that you had proposed on interregional commute, you're withdrawing right now.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So we have consensus on moving forward with changes to the bill as we discussed. Julie?
Yeah. I've read this whole memo over and over and over again in the last couple of days, and I got to tell you, I think a lot of these policies that we have all agreed upon today have a lot of merit. And I'm going to be real candid here. I think politically and for many other reasons, we ought to defer this recommendation and pushing these forward right now, because I'm not sure that the senator needs any controversy right now. And quite frankly, if these all went away and any amendments went away and the bill went away, would we be in any worse condition? Could we adopt these policies at JPC about how we operate interregionally ourselves and not be adding to a bill that legislates how we operate and run our own business? There's part of me that thinks we'd be better off without 792 altogether, and I'd be happy to say, you know, maybe we ought to have the BCDC language about going into the new building be a gut and amend and go in there instead, quite frankly. I mean, that may sound heretical, but, you know, I don't think 792 does us any good in the first place. We've been arguing about it for, what, 2 years now, 3 years? And maybe we just need to sit down with a senator and see if he would be happy to focus on a run for Congress and let us live our own lives under our own terms.
My understanding is that these are things there was consensus that would help us, unless I'm hearing this wrong, that to also institutionalize the role of some of the practice, some of the other agencies on the SCS and the things that we would like to see, as I've heard from the discussion.
Frankly, in reading 792 and the bills since then, I don't think that this makes that much difference. We've done a lot of the stuff that was mandated by certain dates already that was done by the original language. I would like to at least refer this back to our executive directors to take a better look at and let us think a little bit longer about this before we go forward. I don't think we need to rush.
Tom?
Thank you. Well, I think that the process is underway, and the senator is going to be able to move the bill.
Right.
And it's his bill, and so I think it's really quite foolish of us to take a position other than to try to cooperate and make it the best bill we can make it. And I think the changes that are being in the amendments, as you indicated, are actually helpful and actually make our job better. So, Julie, I think, you know, it would be great, but he's pretty determined to move forward with or without us, I presume.
My understanding is he may move forward with other amendments if we're not in agreement. And the idea, at least, is he said, where's your comments? Where do you agree? And to the extent we agree, then at least we have something that at least we support and makes sense. Amy?
Well, I think, you know, just picking up on Julie's points in this discussion and the input from the executive directors in crafting this language, I think all this language can be very productive in improving the SCS process going forward. And to me, independent of what the state decides to do, is that this is, these are policies that we can, you know, I would assume that any state action wouldn't preclude us from incorporating these ideas, this process, into the next SCS going forward. I mean, I think these are very good ideas, and I guess it gets to that point of, you know, for example, in the Bay Area, when we developed the SCS process for our, for the Bay region, we went much farther than the other MPOs did around the state. We took on a lot of other issues that were very important to us. I think these elements are an extension of that process. So, you know, I don't think it's an either or. I think it's really something that we can say, you know, whatever happens to that language, and frankly, if given the choice of being able to say this is what we decide for the Bay Area that we think is important, then we have that option, as opposed to having right. The state of California telling us how we get into real minutia of right. our business. So I think that there's a real opportunity here for us to say this is an important part of what we're going to do moving forward, and there may be a better way to right. do that, because one of the challenges, we go back to public input, one of the challenges that we face is, you know, it is the state telling us what to do, or are we as a region taking the destiny in our own hands? And we've talked a lot about engaging local communities a lot more. You know, I don't think the lack of state action would preclude us from adopting these ideas in our next, the next process. So
I have a question of so the staff. My understanding is that we can do all, under our statutory authority, the SCS is to include certain things. Can we actually go forward include other things in an SCS that are not specifically authorized by statute? Because SB 375 says SCSs are to include certain things. So the other things that we're clarifying here that we believe we should do, what is our ability to do those things if we don't have statutory authority to do them?
I'll start, and certainly Ezra can chime in. But my understanding, Mr. Chairman, is to the extent that you want to try to mandate change on another set of institutions through the SCS, you need to do what the law authorizes you to do and no more. To the extent you want to, say, hand out money, as we're doing with the One Bay Area Grant Program, that's not authorized in SB 375, but we decided to do it anyway. So I do think there's a lot of concepts in these amendments and in the underlying bill that we could probably undertake whether the bill passes or not. Whether we could get reimbursement for it is another question. It would not have the force of law. But for the most part, the areas where we've I think taken some initiative beyond the law have been areas where we thought what we did would be fairly well received, and I think it generally has been.
I would say inserting these provisions into the law is a substantial commitment on the part of the agencies and captures this moment in time where we have worked hard to generate consensus. It's certainly true, in my view, that we can write a land use plan and incorporate performance measures that are in there. But what would happen if there are changes in our agency or changes in leadership and of anything? You know, how does that live on? So I think it's a very significant consideration to put it into law. Second, it creates a stronger partnership between the state agencies who are very interested in regions taking leadership on specific areas that they know that they can't, because they cannot assess the local conditions like we can. And third, I think there are resources that are going to be coming through the state that will look favorably upon the Bay Area taking on this significant step by including in the law on a voluntary basis these commitments.
So is there someone, Scott, and then let me ask if someone wants to make a motion on this. Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In reading through the bill, I just can't help
but agree with Julie. There's really nothing in this bill we can't do on our own. And I don't think we need to be told to set up a website. I don't think we need to be told to have an advisory committee, because each one of these, I can't speak to BCDC, but I know that ABAG, MTC, and the Air District have advisory committees. I don't think we need to be told to follow the Brown Act. But maybe there's just some people here today that believe it's something that we have to have the state tell us to do. So if that was the case, then maybe we should move forward and stay at the table. But I would recommend that we do something else. And that would be to ask Amy and Julie to both go talk to Mark as chairs of MTC and ABAG and see if this is something he really wants to continue to pursue. I don't think he cares either way at this point. I think even some of the stuff that maybe he did want in this bill are gone now. So, I agree with what Julie's saying, that we should just do it on our own and quit acting like we need the state to tell us what to do.
Maybe a thought is that if there's agreement and consensus on these four, on all these issues, have the chairs of the four regional agencies.
I picked them, John, because they actually...
Let me say why I think him. It should be all four. Because, frankly, part of this bill affects Bay Area Quality Management District and BCDC. So all four, no one's excluded, meet with the senator and say, we have consensus over these points, but we really want to understand if you really want to move this bill, or we have some discussion about whether we do these things on our own. So we let them know that there is a consensus, but at the same time express this point of view that maybe we should do this on our own, and have all four executive directors meet with him about this issue.
I don't really care. I mean, the reason I picked these two, and I guess I could have added you.
I'm saying the four regional agencies. It doesn't have to be chair of JPC.
Can I speak? Because I actually kept my mouth shut.
Sure.
The reason I picked Amy and Julie is because they're both from Contra Costa County, and that's why I said I could have easily picked you too. I think they have a better relationship, but I don't care if you send four. I don't care if you send the whole group. But I think there needs to be a follow-up discussion with him to check his pulse. So if you wanted to agree in concept but ask that the four agency chairs go talk to the senator to see if this is something that he wants to continue to pursue, then I would so move that.
Which would be Nate Miley, Zach Wasserman, and Julie and Amy.
Zach.
Right.
Yes.
They're four regional agencies. The motion is that there is agreement and consensus on these issues where there was consensus. I think it's important to state where there's consensus, and that the four regional, the four chairs will meet with the senator to discuss his plans for the bill, and whether to pursue this on their own, but that there is consensus and for four to meet.
Yes, and the four chairs would report back to the full board.
Right. Okay. Does that make sense? Is there a motion? Is there a second? Any other discussion?
Well, I just want to say,
Tom?
I think having the framework of the bill is very important.
Yes.
It takes it out of the realm of guesswork. And people saying, what are you going to do? What are you not going to do?
Right.
This spells it out, tells what you're supposed to do, puts a roadmap in place. So I don't think that's a good idea. He's not going to, what are you going to do? Tell him to drop your bill? You've had this bill for 2 years now. Drop it?
I mean, I agree with you that ultimately he's going to pursue a bill whether or not there's consensus here. To the extent we convey that there's consensus and the four directors meet, I think it's important to state that we reach consensus by all of us, and the four will meet, and that is how it will get conveyed, and we'll report back. Okay? All in favor of that?
Yes. Aye.
Aye. Okay. Opposed. Former Assemblyman Bates. I do feel somewhat embarrassed that we've had an executive office of the Air Resources Board here and has 15 minutes to make a presentation. But so why doesn't he come up? And we should have probably changed it around. Richard. We've had a lot of discussion in the region about use of cap and trade revenues, and he's going to make, including assuming that we're going to use certain cap and trade revenues in our regional Plan Bay Area. So thought it was appropriate to have the Executive Officer of the Air Resources Board talk a bit about cap and trade.
John, just on a process standpoint, is there somebody in this room immediately after us? Is there a reason that we can't stay a few minutes longer if we have the time to do that? We can stay
beyond 12. Sure. So we can go beyond 12. So are folks prepared to stay past 12? At least most of you? Okay. We'll do that. All right. So it looks like you have the time you need. Great.
Thank you, Chairman Joya. I actually wasn't going to complain about being cut short. It was really okay. So,
and you got to hear our great discussion about regional government here.
You know, what I was going to comment on is, because I'm thinking about the overall climate program, scoping program, or scoping plan, and realizing how important local actions and local decision-making is. And one of the elements that we've tried and are always trying to be more effective is capturing in that update the significant local leadership on climate-related issues, really substantial, and the fact that there's a lot of local competition, which is a good thing because I think it pushes action and is part ultimately a key part of the solution. I also wanted to mention that a priority of mine is, as executive officer of ARB, so I've been with ARB about 29 years, just moved through the ranks, and executive officer about a year, is partnerships at the local level and how important those are. In fact, you have Jack Broadbent and Gene here, who our working relationship with their districts is a key part, in my view, of success and being able to effectively move forward with respect to air quality-related issues, and something we're very proud of. And we have a long ways to go, but we have some pretty significant successes that we are won't ignore, need to point to. So I think with that, here's the next slide. What my objective for this presentation is, I wanted to talk about the process to get to the proposed budget for the expenditure of the cap and trade proceeds. I wanted to talk about what basically is the proposal, how did we get here, and what are the next steps. And I have one brief caveat, and that is, given that the fact that the budget proposal has recommendations of apportionment of dollars to different organizations and agencies, I'm not an expert on those other agencies, but I can certainly describe the basic categories and the process that they plan to go through, including ARB, which I'm certainly familiar with. So with that, let me start at the highest level because I think it's important, and that is that cap and trade is one policy. It's an important policy, but it's a policy under the umbrella of AB 32, and it's intended to be included in the suite of strategies that are going to get us to the 1990 emissions level by 2020. So that's explicitly called out in AB 32. That's a required target. And then there's language, and we'll talk a little about this later, about continuing and maintaining reductions post-2020. So as we developed the first scoping plan back in 2008, it recognized that there's not a silver bullet, there's not one solution to climate, there's not one emission source. It's basically consumption of energy, a whole range of fuels, gasoline, diesel, natural gas, that contribute, and transportation's about 40% of that. Recognizing that, there are a range of strategies that have been implemented over the last several years. And the fact of the matter is, some decades ago, before it was called climate change, energy efficiency is a huge climate strategy. So cap and trade is part of a suite, including low carbon fuel standard, motor vehicle efficiency standards, energy efficiency, landfill measures, a whole range of measures. The benefits of the cap and trade program, it includes a hard cap, it includes annual reductions, it includes annual reporting, and our ability to track, are we continuing to reduce emissions? And it does that under a cap that provides some flexibility. As part of the design of the cap and trade program, it was recognized that the auction of allowances, basically instruments that facilities turn in at the end of an obligation period to demonstrate in aggregate that we are declining emissions, that the cap is declining, that a subset of those allowances should be auctioned. So the design of the cap and trade program was actually not intended. It wasn't designed to raise proceeds. It was designed to have the lowest cost path. It just happens to be having auctions as part of an overall cap and trade strategy is a lower cost path than some of the alternatives. As an effect or result of the allowances that we auction, and this auction, first auction was in November of 12, we do them every quarter. It's raised about $650 million up to this point. For first fiscal year, 13-14, $500 million of that was loaned to the general fund, and you're probably all familiar with that, how that played out. So the process that we're working through now, or that the administration's working through, is that they put a budget out, proposed budget for 14-15. Next slide. In fact, you can stay on this slide, but a few more points that I wanted to mention on the last one that actually are pretty key. With respect to AB 32, it defined that the overall objectives are to reduce GHG emissions. But we're to consider a whole range of other factors, co-benefits, reduction of co-pollutants, criteria pollutants, toxic pollutants, job-related creation opportunities, making sure we're minimizing leakage effects, that we're not exporting businesses and just having them have emissions outside of the state. Those were all driving principles within the design of the program. And another key element, and I'll get to this when we talk about a bill that was signed in 2012, is protecting and recognizing disadvantaged communities, particularly their vulnerability to climate change-related issues, as well as the range of other challenges they face with criteria pollutants and otherwise. Following AB 32 and really following the adoption of the cap and trade regulation. So we've been implementing the regulation since 2010 was reporting, 2011 we started down the trail of reducing GHG emissions from facilities. In 2012 there are a few laws that were passed, and they all pertain to the implementation of the cap and trade program, and in particular they focused on the cap and the proceeds that would result from cap and trade. So they established an account where the cap and trade proceeds would be deposited. So that's an account that the ARB oversees. Those monies sit there until the legislature appropriates them, but we're accountable and responsible for overseeing those dollars. There were also bills written, Senator De Leon, for instance, SB 535, that concerned how those dollars are directed with respect to benefiting disadvantaged communities. So there's specific language in that bill that 25% of the auction proceeds are to be spent or directed to the benefit of disadvantaged communities, and 10% of those dollars actually spent in disadvantaged communities. And SB 1018, so which concerned the consideration of the range of consideration of co-benefits. In other words, when you're considering the use of the proceeds, not only for GHG reductions, where can you get the other benefits? Where can you get the maximum bang for the buck in terms of consideration of the use of those dollars? Next slide. So what the overall proposal includes, and this is this year's 14-15 budget proposal, includes $850 million. And I'll talk in a few minutes about how that proposal or those dollars are apportioned. But the way they're built up from a few things. One, they're built up from dollars that were remaining from 13-14, so auction proceeds that were uncommitted, so in addition to the $500 million that I mentioned, it was loaned to the general fund, a repayment from the general fund, $100 million, and the anticipated, or I'm going to say a conservative assumption concerning the proceeds from the auctions that will be conducted over the course of 14-15. So collectively, that's how you build up the $850 million proposal in this year's budget. Next slide. And the proposal includes a range of strategies. And I want to back up on this because I think it's really a key point, and that is that this year's budget proposal really follows from a process that we, and I say we, it's the administration, agencies, and a whole range of other folks that work through a stakeholder process, developing an investment plan. So we under, in fact, it was the bill before it was AB 1532, required that every 3 years that an investment plan or an investment plan be created that really provided a game plan for future budgets in terms of where the opportunities for GHG reductions, which goes back to where the emissions, and it really provided a breakdown analysis that worked through a whole series of public workshops on looking at transportation, energy, natural lands, treatment of wastes, GHG emissions from waste, and as well as the consideration of the co-benefits that I talked about in terms of criteria pollutant, disadvantaged communities, and so on. And what that investment plan did, and it was relatively high level, so it's not project specific, it's more project category focused, was to identify an overall game plan that included here are the opportunities and here are these how these opportunities relate to the sources of emissions. But a key theme both in that investment plan and that played out in the stakeholder process, the workshops, as well as the legislative hearings over the last few years, has been looking at a balanced portfolio strategies, including a balanced portfolio in terms of those that might get reductions today, as well as in some cases making the investments now for those much larger strategies that could pay off in the long run, but have some ramp-up time. Transportation projects would be an example of that. You're not going to get a reductions from a transportation project that you start today. You're not going to see reductions next year, but you have potential of massive reductions and a whole range of other benefits to communities. It was recognizing that point and building it into this overall investment strategy. Next slide. So this budget, this proposal, if you break it down into the major categories that are identified or proposed to receive the apportionment of the $850 million, really the largest category is rail modernization, sustainable communities, and clean transportation at $600 million. Energy efficiency and clean energy at 140, natural resources and waste at 110, and I'll go into each of these in a little bit more detail. Next slide. Starting on rail modernization, it's $300 million, including these themes that are called out here, and high-speed rail is $250 million of that. Rail modernization is $50 million, with the theme of getting projects on the ground, realizing GHG benefits, as well as the range of co-benefits that I'm talking about. And this is clearly one of the examples of projects that take time to get off the ground but have the potential for significant benefits resulting from those investments. Next slide. Transportation sector proposal. And this includes sustainable communities and clean transportation, $100 million for sustainable community strategies, $200 million for clean transportation. Recognizing, and this is an important theme because I just in listening to the discussion today, recognizing the support that 375 needs, recognizing the substantial benefits that those strategies can play, and recognizing the need. I mean, the need is clearly well beyond $100 million, but I think there is recognition, and I'm clearly hearing that in the different hearings that I've gone to, in terms of this is a start, there's clearly a larger need, and there's clearly expectation of future budgets continuing to build on this theme and this need in terms of helping to move the needle here. And I'd make that argument for clean transportation as well, which includes support for particularly cleaning up sources of diesel emissions, dealing with diesel emissions near population distribution centers, ports, areas particularly where you have disadvantaged communities, and we get a co-benefit. We get a reduction in black carbon, we get a reduction in GHG emissions, and we get the associated toxics benefits by reducing near source exposures. So that's an area that is a key theme that we anticipate being repeated over in future budgets. Next slide. Energy efficiency and clean transportation. weatherization projects, energy efficiency improvements in state buildings, recognizing the role that methane plays with respect to the ag sector, and how can we, methane, which is a short-lived climate pollutant, what are the additional strategies that can be taken to reduce these extremely potent GHG gases and do them in a way that is going to be sustainable long-term and provide co-benefits? And more efficient use of what are efficiency-related projects. Next slide. And natural resources proposal really that gets at a range of urban forest, fire protection, wetlands restoration, which gets at, listening earlier today in terms of the resiliency question, there are a number of projects that actually deal with resiliency and GHG benefits and actually are produce basically those co-benefits, and I think that's going to continue to be an important area and what was clearly intended to be reflected in this budget proposal. Next slide. So in terms of process, what is out is the beginning of the process. I heard a reference during this meeting to we're going through the budget hearings now. Those budget hearings will play out over the next several months. I know many of you are quite familiar with how that process plays out. Folks are having both the conversations in the public setting and certainly the conversations behind the scenes, recognizing that there's a zero-sum game in terms of the dollars, and the needs far outstrip the dollars. There's no doubt about that. So it's obviously a public policy debate that goes on in terms of how do you best apportion those dollars, but how do you also tee up and recognize the fact that the way we view the climate program and the cap and trade program, we see the cap and trade program as a long-term strategy. We've already put out in our update to our roadmap, which is an update to the scoping plan, our perspective that the cap and trade program, as part of the broader suite, low carbon fuel standard, energy efficiency, and other strategies, is a long-term strategy to keep the state on track for reducing emissions of GHG. Greenhouse gases, as well as providing other co-benefits. We anticipate continued auctions. So my point is we anticipate continued revenue streams to really support and bolster the very categories that I'm talking about here. So even as we're thinking about this year's budget, which is really critical and much, I think, debate that will continue as that the May revise comes out and the budget's ultimately acted on by the legislature, is thinking about future plans, future budgets, and where those priorities are continue to be identified and where those dollars will be best directed. In terms of the appropriation, when the legislature acts on the budget, the way that this budget was structured in terms of $850 million, it was really relying on existing programs, existing structure to deliver those dollars rather than creating new brand new programs that require a lot of overhead and staff. They wanted to efficiently go with existing programs, existing structure to get those dollars out the door. So if you look at the breakdown for the 850, if I use ARB as the example with $200 million, those are through existing programs that basically direct dollars at the local level to get diesel trucks off the road, to move to hybrids, to move to zero-emission vehicles, those types of things, as well as an incentive for zero-emission vehicles. And each of the agencies that would be receive proceeds have their respective public processes and the process that they would go through, in many cases, solicitations, grants, and the associated steps that they traditionally have followed to award those dollars. So I think with that, I was going to conclude, but to leave open after we have an opportunity to talk with you all, I was going to leave my contact information with Allison, because certainly if folks have follow-up questions, whether it be about cap and trade or the range of other opportunities or areas that ARB focuses on, that's something I'm always willing and prepared to talk with you about.
Thank you, Richard. Let me make a couple comments. Yesterday at the Bay Area Quality Management District Board meeting, we had a lot of discussion over an issue that's very relevant for the Bay Area, and that's the requirement that 25% of the cap and trade revenues be spent to benefit disadvantaged communities. And there's been what's called a tool, EnviroScreen tool, developed by CalEPA that ranks and defines the disadvantaged communities. And if you look at the current map, they selected the top 10% of disadvantaged communities and defined them as the top 10. The result of that is many, many more communities are in Los Angeles, Southern California, the Central Valley, and a few in the Bay Area. If that was expanded to include the top 15% of disadvantaged communities or top 20%, it would include more communities in the Bay Area. So that was a relevant point, and I know you're aware of that issue. Because of the density issues and the way that weren't factored in the same way, you have almost the whole Central Valley in defined as disadvantaged communities, and obviously they have issues, and they are, and much of Southern California, especially around the ports, but the net effect is not as many disadvantaged communities in the Bay Area. So I think we're hopeful that that definition is well, we're not changing the definition of disadvantage. What happens is if it goes to the top 15% instead of the top 10% disadvantaged communities, it widens and includes more Bay Area communities. And given the 25%, that's an issue for that we expressed and had a fair amount of discussion at the Air District, and I'm sure it applies to all of us here. So that was one. Second, I know this is the governor's budget. It may go through some changes. Third, what could affect this revenue, but I think people don't, you know, I'm not sure if they give this much chance of passage, but Senator Steinberg has a bill that would take, you know, in 2015, transportation fuels are supposed to come under the cap and would generate additional revenues for cap and trade. Senator Steinberg has a bill that would take transportation fuels out from the cap and instead replace it with a carbon tax, meaning the projected cap and trade revenues would not be as great going forward, only if this proposal for the carbon tax passes, because the carbon tax revenue can be used for anything, not necessarily for reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. So those, I just wanted to add those comments. So are there questions? Yes. Yeah. And your mic so we can hear you, Jim.
I'm sorry, I thought it was on. I'd like to know what local administrators are. And as I look at this chart, I feel that we're at the bottom of the funding food chain. Is that correct?
Or are we even there?
No, of course not. But let me, I think the way to think about the, it really goes back, and I was said it very quickly, but it goes back to each of the agencies that receive funding. And let me give you an example. For the sustainable communities, the way the budget proposal is structured is those dollars would go through the Strategic Growth Council. And Strategic Growth Council would work with generally it'd be MPOs. The Strategic Growth Council would draft guidelines, work with MPOs on proposals. And that's where the awarding process would take place. But the answer is a function of what is the actual program. And in some cases, for instance, the program, I referred to the example of ARB. And the to the extent that we receive proceeds, a good portion, this is true historically, where we work with local air districts, and those dollars actually are direct to the local level. So it's a function of the individual program and the structure. The only point I would add to this, because I'm picking up on your point, is that a point that I made, and it was a driving principle with this year's budget, it was the point that I made about, is there existing infrastructure to deliver those dollars, existing programs, because the legislature generally what they're doing is appropriating to agencies. But the thinking about going forward, future budgets, are there more efficient ways to direct those dollars? Is there an apportionment where even additional monies are directed at the local level? I think that's going to be a theme that's really considered. But this budget basically is based on those dollars, a good share end up directing, getting it local, but basically they are going through existing programs, so they are, the appropriations are to state agencies that turn around and allocate.
So it sounds like an example that, for example, to the extent there's $200 million allocated to the California Air Resources Board for low-carbon transportation, that would go through the Air Resources Board to the local air districts based on proposals of, and that has yet to be developed, right? I'm serving on the Air Board, that has not yet been developed, but the idea is it would go through Air Resources Board predominantly, not all, but I guess predominantly to local air districts to implement various programs for GHG reduction.
And that's correct on a portion of the dollars. And really, that's a consistent response to the other appropriations, because it's not the agencies that are actually spending those dollars. They're generally going down to the local level. How it's done, and is there a more efficient way to do it, and that whole conversation, that's always a fair discussion.
There is a more efficient way of doing it, of course. I still want to know, I didn't get my question answered. Where is our MPO, ABAG, our agent, where are we on that chart?
Funding recipient. Those would be the funding recipients.
So we're at the bottom of the...
Or local administrators.
What is a local administrator? What is that?
Yeah, what would that be?
What is that?
And it's a generic slide, recognizing that I've got a dozen, two dozen categories, right? So in the case of an MPO, they're directly working with the Strategic Growth Council with respect to proposals. So to me, that is a local administrator and a recipient in that case.
So Strategic Growth Council would be the state agencies, which are the heads of various state agencies, distributing it to MPOs, who would be the local administrators, right?
Yes.
The local administrators would be, for example, the MPOs. But potentially the funding recipients could be the MPO or cities and counties, right? So they could be both of those.
Mr. Chairman, can I just chime in on this one? Because we've seen some information that's at odds with that explanation.
Right.
What we've seen, Richard, is information that the administration's developing where the Strategic Growth Council is proposing adding quite a bit of staff from some of that $100 million, $150 million, whatever it was, I forget our number. And it sounded like that was for the purpose of them selecting the projects, so that we would be in the position of a recipient, not an administrator. We would certainly favor the approach where we are the administrator. The SGC, if they'd like to set policies and those sorts of things, we think that's entirely appropriate. But we've got an entire infrastructure here to administer funds, and we don't have to hire anybody to do it.
How about this? Because I want to make sure that I'm the explanation that I have had is that, and you're correct, there is a proposal for a few staff. Actually, I think it's a relatively small number of staff added to the Strategic Growth Council to assist with the guidelines, as I understood them, but with the proposals coming from MPOs. What I'll do is get the Strategic Growth Council representative to speak directly with folks. That's the most direct way to handle that.
Okay.
I think that is the piece that I think we're worried about the most. We've gone through a process with the Strategic Growth Council on some of the bond money, and it's gone in some cases okay and in some cases not. And given the fact that this is intended to be an ongoing source of revenue for a long time to come, we do think the state should take advantage of the infrastructure that in part it's already financed at these MPOs, where we pick projects morning, noon, and night. That's what we do.
Yeah. Now, I understand you. What I'm going to do is I'm going to connect you directly, because I think that's probably the best way to move forward in that conversation.
Amy?
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, Mr. Corey, I just want to thank you, first of all, for coming today. But I also want to kind of go back in time a little bit, because, you know, SB 375 was passed by the state legislature, and then local government was empowered and charged with implementing it. And first of all, I want to thank you for your work with our organizations, with MTC and ABAG, as we work through this process. I think one of the most rewarding times of that process was when we in fact got to bring the plan to Sacramento. It was a very exciting course, because our Contra Costa representative that was his first day on the air board. But also the fact that what we heard back from your board was that you are doing exactly what we had intended in this legislation. And as you know from our earlier discussions, the Bay Area took on even more responsibility relative to some of the issues that are defined in the cap and trade, for example, reaching out to all the communities, particularly in the final vote included allocating, you know, the 25% to disadvantaged communities that you know, Supervisor Gioia put forward in the language, and Supervisor Campos. And but the other thing I think that's really important, and I think picking up on Steve's point, is that we have created this structure. We have this structure in place to be able to implement this, and the biggest factor are the funds. And I guess, and I understand that this is an ongoing process, and the state, the governor's presented one budget, and then the legislature, there's legislation in place. You know, I guess the concern I have is when we start moving the funding decisions farther and farther away from where the money is actually going to hit the ground, you know, the less of the ability to really achieve the long-term goals. Particularly now, I guess one of the other pieces is, I understand, is that the initial auctions really focused on stationary sources, right? And then at some point, we're going to get to the pay at the pump.
The transportation fuels come under it in 2015.
Exactly. So there, we're going to start to really see the nexus between the local fee payer and how do you implement those programs at that local level. So, you know, I know this is ongoing, but I think that we've put in place this, you know, what do they call it, capital absorption. We've put in place this system here. We've got cities and counties and agencies locally that are engaged in this. We've got these programs. So, you know, again, I think there's a benefit if the overall goal is in fact to achieve the greenhouse gas targets, to achieve the housing production and the transportation investment targets. You know, we put together in December a plan for the utilization of what we felt was the fair share of cap and trade dollars coming to the Bay Area that talks about all these issues. And I guess the concern I have will we be able as a region to be able to implement those goals, you know, under kind of some of these various scenarios.
And maybe you should say who is on the Strategic Growth Council. Why don't you state for everybody the members?
The
agencies.
Chairman Joy, I know I've got John Laird, Resources. I've got Secretary of Cal EPA, Matt Rodriguez. And
Business Commerce, the Business Transportation
Business
folks.
Transportation's on it. And
OPR.
Ken Alex, you've got Brian Kelly at Caltrans, and I'm missing somebody.
Yeah, are you on it?
I am not.
You're not. So just to be clear, he's being the messenger. He's not. So the Strategic Growth Council, right, is made up of, so first it's the governor's budget subject to the legislature, and then the Strategic Growth Council, and just so you know, right, in my role as president of the State Association of Counties, when we met with the Department of Finance, we actually, on behalf of local government, stated that we believe $100 million for the SES was not sufficient and that should increase. Likewise, at the Air District yesterday, they believe there should be even more toward low-carbon transportation, which goes through the right now the Air Resources Board. So I think there's a lot of folks who believe, right, all of these allocations are not enough, and so we'll see where this ends up. Jack, yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. First of all, Richard, I wanted to personally thank you for being here, and it's quite comforting to talk with somebody, or at least be in the room with somebody who speaks our air quality speak, so thank you very much. As you can tell from Commissioner Wirth and others, the SCS here in the Bay Area was something that was worked on for years, a lot of collective discussion, a great public policy work moving forward, and frankly, the rest of the state ought to model it. Can you speak a little bit about the SES and its role relative to AB 32 and the scoping plan that you're going through right now? Because you're going through a fairly significant update of that scoping plan, and I believe you're talking about your June board meeting, I think, June possibly this summer. The SES plays a role, but how big of a role does it play? And that might inform the JPC.
No, thanks, Jack. That's actually a really good point. So the scoping plan, I mentioned that the original scoping plan done in 08, it focused on what are the strategies, the suite, to get us to the 1990 emissions in 2020. The update does really two things. One, it's intended to answer the question, how are we doing with respect to meeting the 2020 target? Story is that based on the measures that have been adopted, the actions taken, we're on track to meet that 2020 target. two, equally important, probably I'd say more importantly, it provided an update on climate science with the issuance of the IPCC's fifth assessment and a range of other studies that have been done. The case for climate change and the impact that it is having, particularly and the particular vulnerability that California faces, is stronger today than it was back when the original scoping plan was done. Three, it underscores the importance of getting at short-life climate pollutants and the role that they play and the potential benefits getting out of the gate with additional reductions of these particularly potent greenhouse gases, including methane, HFCs, and black carbon. Although it's not a gas, it's an extraordinarily potent climate forcer, and you all know toxic pollutant issues as well. And the plan also underscored the point, the importance of a midterm target in the 2030 timeframe to continue to keep us on track for ultimately a 2050, 80% reduction below the 1990 emissions, and have a milestone along the way, provide certainty to the businesses and others. And we did not, and many of you are very aware of this, why we there is a balance that was struck, one in underscoring the importance of a midterm target, but not calling out a target, because there's a number of legislative discussions that are going to that point. So the scoping plan serves as a platform, what we believe, to establish the target, be that direct ARB or others to establish it. So that those discussions are playing out right now. But directly to your point, Jack, the plan also underscores not only how we've collectively, we collectively have moved forward in terms of a 2020 target, it recognizes we have a long ways to go. And if you look at transportation fuels and energy and waste and natural resources, the fact of the matter is there's significant additional action that's going to be necessary. And the scoping plan tees up the need for those actions, the recognition of the magnitude of emissions from these categories, and the fact that many of the actions can provide significant co-benefits, both in criteria pollutants, lifestyle-related issues as well. What it didn't do, what it does is tee up a process going forward, and it recognizes cleaner transportation, cleaner vehicles, and livable communities, and the role that sustainable communities are going to play in reducing transportation and put people closer to their jobs. So it doesn't have what you don't see in the update are numbers, because it recognizes that the categories I just talked about are strongly interrelated to one another. We need to establish a midterm target. We need to work on a process to move forward on fuels, to move forward on energy, and to do it in a smart, integrated way. But at the local level, it's going to play a huge role in terms of meeting those targets.
Richard, let me ask you something that's relevant to this, because I think this is important to understand. When we think about how much how we're spending cap-and-trade revenues, we want to relate it to how much the activity contributes to reaching our 2020 goal. So in one of the earlier analyses I've seen, and you've probably seen this, so I want to, it may be updated, and I think this is relevant. What I saw, and this is that to get to the 2020 goal, which is our 1990 levels, that eight cap and trade, the cap and trade program contributes to getting there 18%. Again, this may change. This was from an earlier. The low carbon fuel standard, which is to make our move toward alternative fuels, less carbon intensity in our fuels, gets 15%. Advanced clean cars, 4%. The SCS, 3%. Renewable portfolio standard, 11%. Energy efficiency, 12%. High global warming potential gases, 6%. Other measures, 11%. Have those numbers changed much, or is that... That was earlier.
They're approximately the same. So the projected 2020 emissions without AB 32, and this is revised based on the economic downturn in 08, it's about 507 million metric tons. The 1990 emissions target is basically 427. So we basically need about an 80 million metric ton reduction, and the apportionment, as you described, is about right. But a key point on that is if you look at a midterm target,
You
look at a long term,
right.
The whole distribution of those percentages shifts.
So my point is that to get to the 2020 goal, which is reducing us by 80 million metric tons, these are the activities that get us to 2020. So SCS is going to have more of an impact later on a midterm goal in 2030 and 2050, which is also probably why the money is distributed or proposed to be distributed this way to be able to reach the 2020 goal, which is 40% of the 2020 goal is met through low carbon fuel standard and cap and trade, and then the other measures making up the difference. So that's, I think, a relevant number to understand because we all play a role at different points in this process. So the SCS doesn't get us as much to the 2020 target. It gets us to a 2030 or 2050 target.
Can I ask a quick question, too?
Yeah.
Does this go any towards transit operations?
That was...
I just think that would be a huge area where we could see some reductions.
You mean... a lot of the low carbon goes to electrify the
actual
bus fleet, correct?
I was thinking public transit operating
right.
costs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the capital shortfall. I mean, we're looking at getting people out of cars into transit.
Right.
So that,
right.
Independent of land use decisions.
Right.
Yeah. Is that, I don't see any of that money.
I don't think it currently
there.
Does no. cover it.
I think the governor's budget has money for, right, puts it in rail, and then the rail modernization, and of course, high-speed rail, and then the SCS potentially... It's been not determined what portion of that SCS could potentially be public transit as well, I assume. The SCS, right now it's $100 million for SCS, $200 for low-carbon fuel, right?
It's an ongoing challenge, though.
Clearly there's
the
a challenge for
piece.
Public transit, right?
Yeah.
Ezra?
I just want to clarify one point that I thought I heard you say, that you believe that 375 is going to play a huge role in meeting future targets. Did you say that?
What I said was that as we're looking at a 2030, ultimately a 2030 target and a 2050 target, that if you look at from a GHG standpoint, so I just said that the 2020 target's 427 million. And if you had a long range target of 80% below 1990, you're at about 50 million. My point is, everything's going to be important. Transport. In fact, just to, because I think actually illustrates the point really well. HFCs, the refrigerants that we use in our cars and there are air conditioners at home, these are really potent substances. In fact, not as potent as they used to be because they've replaced the substances that used to deplete ozone. If you look at but it's a category that's growing. Most of these categories are declining through the range of strategies that I've talked about. It's actually increasing. Partly it's increasing because of the ODS replacement. But that category alone, if you looked at the projections post-2020, 2030, 2040, if it stays on the trajectory it's on, and basically this underscores the need for action, that one category alone would represent 50% of the GHG emissions for a mid or long, basically a long post-2030 target. One category that today is viewed as fairly modest, fairly insignificant.
So it sounds like, to be intellectually honest, what we need to do is we set a 2030 midterm and looking at 2050, that we do the same analysis to understand what role each plays. Let me just say, as someone in local government, I think we sit here and we understand how important SCS is, but we also, I think, need to understand that there's a lot of other things that get us to GHG reduction. So we spend the money, I'm just saying this as an individual, we spend the money in a way that's proportionate to the strategies that get us there. So for example, if a 2030 target is met by a different proportion here, I mean, then that's a guiding point. But at some point, it's not just by the seat of our pants and saying we think we're going to get this reduction. We need to have some real analysis to understand what gets us there and update this proportion, and that's what helps us guide how to spend the money, right? And not spend too much money in an area that doesn't get the reductions and spend not enough, you know, or in an area that where we need to get more reductions.
Right.
So I think we need to be careful not to be advocates for what we're doing alone, but be advocates for what gets us to the target.
So I would just say to that that 375 would require substantial amendment to get more GHG emission reductions than
right.
we have today.
That's
right now
right.
you can't squeeze blood from the stone, as they say, and so
right.
you can't just look at land use in isolation from the
right.
way we're just by reducing VMT, but by the codes and standards that
right.
new growth takes place and where you have opportunities to do retrofit to create more efficiencies. Now, you could use 375 for that purpose, but
right.
that's not what the law says today.
I mean, right now the analysis showed that energy efficiency will account for 12% of getting to the 2020 goal, and SCS will account for 3%. That's the current analysis.
Mr. Chairman, though, I do think there's a complementary point, and that is that the SCS strategy gets you a lot of other co-benefits. In fact, the way I would look at it, GHG is sort of a co-benefit
right.
of an SCS.
Right. Right.
And all of those other benefits ought to matter to the state.
Right.
And I think the more we try to integrate
right.
our environmental
right.
progress,
right.
the better off we are, and just
right.
instead of exalting one thing above everything else.
But in a way, all of these could achieve co-benefits. Reducing pollution, from oil, for example, low carbon fuel standard, it gets you health co-benefits. Likewise, SCS gets you co-benefits. So all, you're right, all of them get you co-benefits. In fact, that's sort of the highest priority. What, you know, not just reducing GHGs, which is the same discussion we had here when we passed Plan Bay Area.
I mean, I guess if I can pick up on that, those points, and I recognize one of our discussions when we were doing Plan Bay Area was the fact that a lot of these environmental goals, particularly air quality, and having lived in Los Angeles in the 70s and 60s, we know that technology is going to play a huge role, whether it's reducing GHG, improving air quality, and we realized through One Bay Area that there are a lot of other co-benefits. Now, one of the, maybe, and again, I know you're just the messenger, not the governor, but I guess one of the things is this is a huge new revenue source. It's the only new revenue source that's been presented to the state. And I know that these 850, that's just local source. I mean, when we start talking about the cap and trade on refined gasoline, as I understand it, those numbers are going to grow hugely. Right? I mean, aren't they...
What's the estimate?
Yeah. Let me... I need to be very careful about the way I talk about this.
Yeah.
And let me tell you why. And then I'll give you as direct an answer as I can give you. Well, the short answer is we don't know that number, but let me amplify on that. An auction consists of a few right. elements. One, it's the number of allowances that are actually auctioned. And actually, each auction is actually two auctions. It gets complicated. It's current vintage and future vintages that are auctioned. They can clear at different prices, so you don't know if they all clear up front. And then you got to assume what price they'll clear at. We're very careful. In fact, we've learned over the last 2 years to be very, very careful about the way that we talk about the auctions and the way that we talk about offsets, because it has had an impact on the market in terms of the way we communicate our expectations for a given auction. So I needed that caveat out there. But to go to your question, by virtue of, and Chairman Joya's point, by virtue of fuels coming in under the cap in 2015 auctions going forward, and if you look at, for instance, so far, the allowances, the auctions have been clearing up close to the floor. So the floor this year is, I think it's $11.34. So if you had the caveat that we clear at the floor, all the allowances sell, it's probably about in 14, 15, well, actually not 14, 15, 15, 16, because I want a full year of fuels into the cap, you're probably at $2 billion.
Annual $2 billion.
Okay. So when we did our sustainable community strategy, we determined that we have this massive capital shortfall for transit investment, both in terms of capital shortfall and also in terms of transit operations. And clearly, as not a scientist, as a layperson, saying if you can get 40 people out of their cars into one, good quality bus, for example, that's you know, I can't believe that that's only going to move the needle 3%. But, you know, maybe that's true. But it seems to me that we have to set up a funding structure that's going to enable us to do that. And I'm, you know, again, I'm really cognizant of the debate that's going to be coming on in the future to be able to make those broader investments.
I think you raise a point, which is a good point, which is cap and trade is an appropriate source of revenue for public transit. It's not to be relied on, right, for 100% of capital, transit capital needs. There need to be other sources, but it's an appropriate mix, right? So it's an appropriate use. And then how you quantify how many more people you get out of their car, right, into the bus, into public transit, so that you're making the investment in a way that is also, right, similar to the effectiveness of it. So the idea is it's a relevant part of the mix, was what you're saying.
And John, maybe something we can all work on is maybe there's a better metric here for future scoping plan or expenditures, Richard, because, you know, as you build a clean community and you get people out of their cars and they take transit, the way we measure things is somewhat limits us, I think, in terms of how we mm-hmm. can calculate how much of the benefit there is. And I think you would agree there's probably some very good long-term societal benefits by doing these things that don't necessarily get captured by the,
right.
you know, the dollars per greenhouse gas ton
right.
reduced.
And this is where you need it on all ends, right? The PDAs, which are important, priority development areas, establish where you do development that gets people out of their cars and into public transit. But likewise, to be successful, you need to clean the fleet, because remember the whole issue between the Air District and ABAG was you don't want to put people next to a freeway with diesel emissions with health issues. And I know that was a cause of right controversy between the two agencies. So to achieve the PDA goal of getting development near in old industrial areas and an infill, you need to clean the air, have stationary sources not pollute as much, and have cars not pollute as much. So you need to invest the revenue also to clean the fleet and clean the sources of emissions, as well as cause the development to happen nearby.
And actually be able to clean the fleet. So go in and clean the buses and clean the BART trains and right. make the public transit right. an enjoyable experience right. for people as well. So I think that's...
Other comments?
Yeah. John?
Yeah.
Richard, thank you for being here. It's really discouraging how little credit that we're getting for the work that's been done in this region. And that's what I get out of this whole conversation. You know, how you view it and how you're prioritizing the benefits or you know, how you're going to meet that goal. And I'm really disappointed. The Strategic Growth Council, I mean, they're so removed from what we did in this region and the struggles that we've had with our communities. And this is a cultural change that's taking place. And the approach that you've laid out really discourages the people that we represent to really buy into this when you're saying, well, all the things you're doing really has such a small, significant impact on this. So we're going to deal with these bigger issues. But go ahead and make those sacrifices. And the further you get away from the local jurisdictions, all the good work that's being done in this sea change of how we're approaching this, I think it's just being lost. And it's just so discouraging. And to put that Strategic Growth Council between us and that money is absolutely beyond my comprehension. I don't get it. I really don't. And it's very disturbing. And, you know, as I look at this whole process and the work we've done, especially in our region and of all our agencies and in the MPO, and we have really laid the groundwork and a framework for really getting the public behind this thing and really starting to deliver and making some changes in the region. The sacrifices we're making for public transit. Right now we're spending, 70% of our resources on public in our pretty close to it. I mean, one of the highest in the nation. I mean, we're making a commitment to it, yet this doesn't recognize that. And it just is so discouraging. I just can't tell you how discouraging it is for us at the local level that the state takes this very cavalier approach to the good work that the
I think you need to be clear
he's the messenger. That's the very last thing I was going to say. You know, the guy that should be sitting at the table is a representative from that Strategic Growth Council or someone from the state legislature ought to be sitting at the people that are going to make those decisions. No, that's why I said I really appreciate the way he laid it out. This is a reality check for me. This is truly, you know, no good deed goes unpunished fault category. But no, this isn't Richard's doing. I'm just saying it. I just relay it to him. So if he does mm-hmm. talk to any of his colleagues,
well, I certainly will following this discussion here. And I appreciate the candor. I always think the discussions where people can just be straight up are much more effective in terms of identifying the issue, connecting. I know you know who the folks are, but connecting you with the Strategic Growth Council folks, I think, and I understand you're having that dialogue, that discussion needs to happen, needs to play out. But what you heard from me, and it was, now I'm talking with my ARB hat, is the local action, and I explicitly pointed this out because I've seen real examples, many, many examples of local leadership on a range of issues, including climate. I've been incredibly impressed, and it was a priority of mine to capture that in the scoping plan and to capture that in the working relationships we have with folks, realizing we're not going to get there unless those partnerships are strengthened. So something we're going to continue to do, but I understand the points that you've made, and I understand those discussions will continue to play themselves out.
I think we have to remember there's also disputes within local government about where this should go, because I hear from there are cities and counties that also want money to go directly to them and not through MPOs. There are the congestion management agencies that would rather have money go directly to them and not through MPOs. So I think we have our own dispute to think that we're on one sort of frame of mind. There's metropolitan planning organizations, there's congestion management agencies, there's cities, there's counties. Each of them are advocating, I can tell you that, for larger sums of this money at the expense of another level of local government. As the president of CSAC and talking to folks at the League of Cities, they want to see more money directly as well and not necessarily through the MPOs. So I think This is going to be part of the difficult process.
John, if I can add to that, pick up on Jim's comments. First of all, I completely agree. He as articulately states the frustration, and I guess the part I'm seeing is that, you know, I think these local regions have developed these plans, and you know, I'm looking where the money is flowing and who's making the decisions. And you know, I recognize the whole point is to get the money in the ground, is to get the money into the transit, into the buses, into the communities that are doing this, into the, you know, the pathways, all the things that are identified in Plan Bay Area. And my concern is that I don't see, again, this structure, and I'm not criticizing the messenger, I'm criticizing the plan before us and that's been presented by the governor, is that it really doesn't, you know, I think it's really important that we have a way to substantively fund these investments. And when you look at the elimination of redevelopment agencies, the reduction in investments, and all the elements, you know, how can we achieve this? So I recognize there's going to be that conversation in Sacramento. There are a lot of different perspectives on it, but I am very concerned that we have developed this plan. It's a real template for achieving these goals, and frankly, when I see transit, you know, where is the local funds? And we had a very heartfelt discussion in December here at MTC in the Bay Area talking about this very issue of how do we provide transit sustainability with the initiative about the core investment and then, you know, moving forward. So, again, I recognize there are a lot of different views, but, you know, the state has presented this thing, do this sustainable community strategy, and so where are the funds to be able to implement that? And at the local level. That's what's concerning me. I'm seeing these decisions now are going to be made in Sacramento as opposed to locally. And I think each region has its unique priorities set forward, and it's important that the money flow, I think, in that way. And I know there's some legislation out there that's right, addressing some of those issues. And
before we close, let me ask Richard. So to the extent that if it ends up, and we don't know where the budget will end up, that the Strategic Growth Council gets approximately $100 million or some amount for SCS, Is it your understanding that the SCS or that the Strategic Growth Council develops the guidelines and then distributes the money to the metropolitan planning organizations?
That was my understanding, but Steve's question of me on that point made me want to make sure that I've got Strategic Growth Council representatives. I'm going to pose that, and I want them talking directly to you because that was how it was communicated to me. And it's a very important point, obviously, clearly expressed here. But my understanding was as you just described it, but I want to make sure it's correct.
Okay, that's a useful. And then the other point is, again, the definition of a disadvantaged community, so it includes more communities in the Bay Area. It doesn't change how we define disadvantaged communities, but it would say instead of taking the top 10% of disadvantaged communities, even if that were to go down to 15%, we'd be able to identify more communities in the Bay Area because 25% of the revenue, that's a floor, that's not a cap. There will be most likely more than 25% spent. Some of these categories, it's greater than that. So looking at truly what are using the proper definition, I think under the current EnviroScreen tool, it includes the area I represent, Richmond, parts of East Contra Costa like Antioch, parts of Oakland, parts of San Francisco, and maybe parts of San Jose. Jack, is part of San Jose in that?
I'd have to go back and look.
But there would be other disadvantaged communities within the definition that would be eligible if we went to the top 15% instead of the top 10% of disadvantaged communities. And that's an important issue for the Bay Area. And I know I've spoken to Matt Rodriguez, head of CalEPA, about this issue. And it seemed to me that they're open to understanding how to fine-tune the EnviroScreen tool to make sure that it's appropriate.
Yeah, I think, John, the organization that is working on this is OEHA, who has agreed to make some additional further changes. And they've made that commitment. I think it's coming upon us to now say this is...
And then let me maybe at the expense of just raising one related issue is... we had discussion that I raised at the Air Resources Board to make sure that we talk about a definition of what it means to benefit a disadvantaged community. And I think there was agreement at Air Resources Board to sort of look at this issue. There's been some effort statewide to look at this because the statute doesn't define it, so that we don't make benefits some indirect, intangible benefit, like just a rail extension somewhere, let me be honest, that has some peripheral benefit, that it's a real tangible benefit to a disadvantaged community. And so I think we've had some discussion at ARB about whether to include that in a scoping plan because there's no legislative definition, so that we don't have regions of the state spending that 25% money in ways that really don't directly benefit but just is just paper covering. I have one speaker card, Brian Geiser, and then we'll wrap up.
Brian Geiser, I live in Oakland. Since the meetings run late and only half of the appointeds are here, I'll just ask that the staff place the visuals and any supplemental materials on the website for everybody else to see.
That's great.
Thanks.
I think it's good. So all the presentations today, including from Air Resources Board, be great to put on our JPC website. Anything else? Okay, with that, we are adjourned to our next meeting in May. Thanks.